And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show on the road in Denver, Colorado, on the People's Tour for America. Our stop in Denver was an amazing time, Pat. I enjoyed being in Denver.
I loved Denver. It was, that whole ride from Utah into Wyoming and then down into Colorado was just
amazing.
Yeah. Every time I do something like this, I think, now I know why we stole it from the Indians. It makes perfect sense to me again.
And maybe we should steal it back from the corporatists now.
There you go. That's the thing that gets me is these guys, these robber barons and those guys, it wasn't their land.
No. Nope.
And then I got mine, I stole it fair and square, now you can't even have, a decent day's wage.
Yeah, and the whole thing, and Denver was on the trip when we laid all this out. I'm going, I can't wait to go to Denver, because from the time I was a little kid, I had always wanted to go to Denver because I was a huge Broncos fan.
How did you get to be a Broncos fan?
Well, a woman down the street, I used to shovel her driveway, and her nephew was Randy Gratishar, who was the middle linebacker for the Broncos during the Super Bowl years of the 70s.
So she chatted him up all the time?
And I got to meet him.
That's
how I became, it was at that point where, you're wherever. And then there's this moment where you meet this guy, and then you start following.
Was he ginormous to you?
To me, he was he was bigger than life. I mean, he was huge.
Speaking of Salt Lake City, I met Merlin Olsen. Remember him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I met him. And
the florist.
Yeah, and the football player for the Beehive State.
One of the most ferocious football players. And you would have never thought, the guy who was on Little House on the Prairie and the florist guy and actually did some needlework and stuff. You never thought he'd have been one of the most ferocious football players.
He was smaller than Hulk Hogan, right? But he had bigger hands. And when Merlin Olsen shook my hand, I kid you not, our thumbs hooked. And then his fingertips came to my elbow, and they shake your hand like he's pumping water. You know, it was amazing. He was a giant person. Hi, how are you? You're blocking the sun.
But I got to be honest with you. I walked, my wife and I, we went and took the kids and we visited Mile High Stadium, it's Sports Authority Field. At Mile High, which I guess just really took the air out of it for me. We went and everything to me seemed corporatized.
Why, you're a Dick's kind of guy?
I'm kind of none of those kind of guys. I liked it being Mile High Stadium. You know, when we go to Kansas City, I liked it being Arrowhead Stadium. When I grew up in Cleveland, I liked it being Cleveland Municipal Stadium. I don't even know what they call it now.
Boston Garden is TD Bank North or something. It's like, no.
And to me, all of it was corporatized. And I went to the Bronco store because, one of those things, where I live, not much Bronco paraphernalia around to be purchased. So I'm in this sea of Bronco swag. I'm in this sea of all of these things.
The big orange hand.
All of that.
Yeah.
And I'm going, no, I just can't wear a shirt with that big check mark on it.
You mean the Nike swoosh?
Yeah, I just cannot wear something. It's one thing to be, a fan of the team and to promote that, but it's a whole other thing to walk around with corporate advertising.
Without
on
these
myself.
Corporations, young man, you wouldn't have these teams. They wouldn't be there for you.
That's not true.
I know. I'm sorry.
They didn't do that when I was a kid. I mean, you got a
Broncos. I'm playing the part of the corporate sponsor. You need us. You need us. We bring you the things that you like.
And we're the only ones who can.
Yes. If it weren't for us. Exploiting.
There would be no you.
It weren't for Nike selling you $200 sneakers and having a five-year-old in another country. Oh, look at that, how fast that little Korean child is. Lace those shoes, boy. Lace those shoes.
Well, they've got small hands. They can get in there. But I kind of walked away going, all right, I checked this off my list. Because I've always wanted to go to the I want to go to a game.
Nike swished it off your list,
and it swished off my list. And I'm going, there's something seriously wrong with the whole setup.
Okay, so I have a question for you. I think they were there. I went to Mile High Stadium a really long time ago, 2004, and
the old Mile High.
Yeah, were the horses there then?
What do you mean the horses?
Those cool galloping horses.
No, that's a new stadium.
Oh, it is.
I didn't remember
that swiveling lid.
No, that's the new stadium. A couple years ago, they tore the other one down. They built this one. I guess it's been about 5 or 6 years, actually.
Yeah, I was at the old one.
I would have liked to have gone to the old one. Yeah. That wasn't the Sports Authority field.
No, it wasn't.
That was Mile High Stadium.
Yeah.
But, you know, this one, it's a nice-looking stadium, you know, but corporate everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and nothing made in America, by the way.
And that's the other part of it. You know, I was looking at a jersey because, you know, I'll spend a couple of bucks, and if I can get it there, there's something to it. I look at it.
Wear it to an Eagles game.
No. That's how you end up getting killed.
Yeah.
wear it when the Broncos aren't playing the Eagles, right?
Right.
So you just look crazy. you're at the wrong game, guy. No, but I walked up, and I'm looking at all these different clothes, and I'm looking at where they're made, and I'm trying to find something made in the U.S. Because I find it very hard to go and spend hundreds of dollars on something that most
hundreds,
of it is profit.
Hundreds for a shirt?
Yeah. I was going to buy one of the jerseys. And
oh, like the one that they put over the football pads?
Yeah, but it's not really that same thing. This is a cheaper knockoff of that. $300.
For the cheap one?
The only one that they had. The only jersey one they had. The T-shirts.
My God,
the T-shirt was $34.
Wow.
Made in Haiti.
Yeah.
And the baseball cap made in China, $32. And
yeah.
I'm going, you know what?
And that's where they say, well, they shipped the jobs so that the things would be cheaper. No,
where?
They shipped the jobs so that they could make more money and charge the same for the stuff.
Away with from this.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's good that you did that because, first of all, you got to see what you wanted to see. But second of all, you know, as we hear all this other outside rhetoric and as we're posting stuff on Facebook, you know, some of the apologists for the corporate masters are typing, somewhat possessed, I think. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like Jack on The Shining, you know. That's what I think. That half of the United States has just spent too much time at the Overlook Hotel.
No.
You know, they're not thinking for themselves anymore. It's pretty horrifying. But as you go and see these things, you realize, wow, you know, the prices didn't get any cheaper because we lost our jobs. The robber barons just got richer.
But a really, really cute moment happened. And my daughter was walking with me, and my son and my daughter, the younger two, they were just insane. They're running everywhere, just climbing all over everything, and there are things to do that, and that was, you know, that's okay. But my oldest daughter goes, you know, someday we're going to go to a game here, which I just thought was really just sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I do, you know, at some point, you know, you want to go do that. Well, maybe we'll swoosh that off of another list.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was one of those sweet moments. Someday, I'm going to take you.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful.
I mean, yeah. It's one of those things.
You know, your kids are the best part of this trip, I think. They're so much fun. You know, it's not that I'm not crossing my eyes sometimes, because I am. But I really love it. It stops the day from being anything like predictable.
That's one way of looking at it. No, but you know, I look at this. It's a nice stadium. It was a nice city. We enjoyed our time there. In fact, you know, later on in the program, we'll talk to the guy who's the state historian, and they've got a really cool state history museum there,
mm-hmm.
The Colorado History Center, which I wish we would have had time to really go through and explore a little more than we did, but. I really liked our time in the city.
Yeah, a lot of reverence to the Native Americans in that museum, which I was very happy to see. Really pretty cool. Yeah, I loved it. I did take a trip over to, we stayed in Aurora, which, if people are remembering their very recent history, is the site of one of the USA's unique massacres. And I went over to the movie house and saw a bunch of little kids leaving one of the movies. And I thought, really, America? Do we need to make $9.50 a ticket on that movie theater?
Yes. Yes, because if you close that, then I know you think you should close it down or you should do, but if we do that, then they win.
Who they? Crazy medical students?
They win.
I mean, this guy was a crazy medical student.
Yeah, and you don't want him to win.
He didn't represent anything but crazy. He wasn't like, hi, I'm from the crazies and we want to do this. He was just a crazy medical student. And so they don't win. We, as a respectful nation, say, you know what? This and everything. It's not like, wow, he picked a movie theater. For those of you who didn't I mean, we all saw the coverage, but we only saw, like, the flashing lights and the ambulance lights and all that stuff, and then the exit door, and but we didn't see what it was set in. It is literally, you know, King of Prussia,
mm-hmm.
King of Prussia Mall. It's like King of Prussia Mall on steroids. It's like twice the size of King of Prussia Mall,
wow.
The whole area. And then every single national fast food chain, every one of them was there, you know, from Applebee's to you name it. All of these food places everywhere, and it's just a movie theater in the midst of all that consumerism. And they couldn't just say, you know what, very sorry, but the bloodbath is going to be remembered, and these lives that were taken. I mean, I don't understand why we all of a sudden care about something like the World Trade Center when we don't care about the people in Colorado. They're all people. They're all people who are. I guess if we care about Colorado, if we care about Aurora, Colorado, and that movie theater, we might have to actually care that 90% of America wanted background checks, and Congress didn't give them.
Yeah, see, but here
90% of America.
You have that surrender mentality. This is about. This is about them winning.
I can't tell you how many people wish I would have a surrender mentality. I don't have enough ink to write the list of people who wish I would just give up. It is so frustrating, you know? It's so frustrating. And yeah, no. If crazy medical students are what we're afraid of, we've got our list all wrong.
Yeah, well.
You know?
So what should they have done with that property? What should they have done with that site?
You know, I guess, I mean, there isn't even a sign. There isn't even a sign that says, you know, to the however many people that died here.
Well, at least they didn't circle the bullet holes and make a museum out of it and or make it an attraction out of it.
You know, I think maybe what they should do, have you seen the YouTubes of the people who survived asking for background checks? Because this kid was crazy. Right? And I think we could probably talk to the people in Newtown, Connecticut as well. You know, let's talk to the survivors and their families and see what they think there should be. There's no justice when something like that happens and nothing changes. And obviously mental illness is not the only issue we should be discussing here. But, I mean, the kid who did Virginia Tech, all of these people had a background of mental illness. Background checks would have pointed that the guy who shot Reagan. What's his name? Hinckley?
John Hinckley Jr.
History of mental illness.
And the thing that always got me is Reagan lived, so we didn't add that middle name in there.
You know, Reagan, every 20 years a president has died in office.
Except for Reagan.
Right, and it was Reagan's, I don't want to say turn.
It was his
that
turn.
Sounds really awful. Oh, okay, you can say it.
he was next.
But modern science saved him.
Yep, absolutely.
So it would have, and then you know who would have been next? W. And no one counts the fact that from the brainstem up, already gone.
Wow, right there. Right there you went there. Good for you. Going to take a quick break from the People's Tour for America on the road in Denver, Colorado. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For the homeless, for the poor, who cares about the deficit, we want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
And power, we stand and fight together. There is power in a union of many lands. Power, come and reach across the border. Power, come and open up your eyes. Power, we stand and fight together.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers in China held a U.S. businessman in captivity until he reached a compensation agreement for employees concerned that they may be displaced when some jobs are moved to India. Specialty Medical Supplies co-owner Chip Starnes was blocked from leaving when workers became concerned that they may not be fairly compensated if they're laid off. Starnes was allowed to leave after he reached an agreement with a union negotiator. Starnes has said the company wasn't planning to lay off many of the workers who fall under the agreed-to package and told the Associated Press that he'd be rehiring some workers who had been previously let go. A new website is seeking to provide workers with the tools they need to create changes in their workplace. Coworker.org is a petition site that allows workers to build support as they endeavor to create a positive environment on the job. Jess Kutch is one of the co-founders of Coworker.org and provided an example of one way the site is being used successfully.
We have about 12 campaigns running on the site. We're really excited about a campaign that's running right now by Capital Bike Share employees. Capital Bike Share is DC's bike share program, and the employees there believe that they're owed more than $100,000 in back pay, as well as health and welfare benefits from the company. So they launched a petition. They've gotten a ton of local support, and they also got media coverage from outlets all over the country. And this week the company responded and said they're working to rectify the problem very quickly.
The site was inspired by the success Kutch saw with consumer petitions putting pressure on companies.
Workers need more support than a 17-year-old who's trying to ban plastic bags in her town. When you're going up against your boss, you're taking on a lot of risk, and there's a lot at stake. So Coworker.org is really committed to figuring out what kinds of support workers need to win these campaigns.
While the site is still in beta, the team behind Coworker.org are putting together resources that will help inform workers about their rights in the workplace and how to appropriately cope with an employer who may push back against the petition campaign. Macy's has agreed to pay $175,000 after a federal investigation determined the retail chain had discriminated against immigrant employees. The fine includes a $100,000 fund that will compensate the workers who had been unfairly terminated, suspended, or punished. Under the settlement, Macy's denied its practices were discriminatory or unfair. While details of the investigation weren't made available to the public, the Department of Justice said the company used unfair documentary practices.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. We are on the road across the country on the People's Tour for America. You can follow us where we've been, where we're going at peoplestourforamerica.com. Also, Twitter, Facebook, all of those things, ways you can interact with the program and the tour. You know, January 18th, 1909, the U.S. Supreme Court, the Lochner Court, as we've talked about in past shows, they ruled unanimously that, well, against the working people of Colorado, that in Moyer versus Peabody, the governor and officers of the National Guard could imprison U.S. citizens without probable cause and deny them their right to habeas corpus. You know, in times of insurrection, you know, like having the audacity to ask for better wages, hours, and conditions. You know, I think back to, you know, the Bush years, you know, enemy combatant, maybe same thing back during the workers' struggles of the turn of the century. So what happened? They had this audacity to fight for that. They went on strike. Well, Governor James Peabody sent out the militia, put the workers in their place in our Supreme Court, the same court that ruled child labor, those laws, unconstitutional. Maximum hour laws, unconstitutional. Minimum wage, unconstitutional. But taking away workers' right to the constitutional right to their day in court? No problem. No problem at all. I'm here to talk about the history of Colorado and the labor movement and is Executive Director of the Colorado AFL-CIO, Mike Serbo. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
You got it, Rick. What are you chatting with
you? You know, I look at this one court, and I talk about the Lochner Court quite often because, you know, anything that working people wanted, maximum hour laws, minimum wage, get the kids out of the mines and the looms, that stuff was unconstitutional. But you look at this, locking people up for wanting to go on strike and demand better wages, hours, and conditions, perfectly fine in their mind. And I think, you know, I look today, I see a lot of similarities.
Oh, you bet. You bet. Organizing was never easy. There were times when it wasn't as hard as it is now or as it was back in 1909, and the issues are different now. Back in 100 years ago, you used to get killed physically by the powers that be, and now you get killed economically.
Yep.
You stand up for your rights to organize.
So instead of shooting you in the back, they're just going to starve you. It seems much more humane. But I look at Colorado, and, you know, as we've been going across the country talking about labor history in each state, Colorado has a rich and really a very bloody history when it comes to worker management relations. And, you know, you look at some of the gold miners in Cripple Creek or the coal miners in Ludlow. A lot of this stuff, in fact, Colorado had the labor wars during this time of, you know, all of these miners and these big industrialists and these big robber barons using state governments, you know, to really crush working people.
Many, many workers were murdered, maimed back during those labor wars 100 years ago. The most egregious and the most highly publicized, of course, was the Ludlow Massacre, which happened 99 years ago, and we're working with United Mine Workers to prepare for the 100th anniversary of the massacre next year, May in 2014. Actually, the massacre was in April, 1914. The anniversary is going to be memorialized next May. A lot of history. Coming out of the Ludlow Massacre, led the, after the massacre, the movement came about to more or less, quote, humanize workplaces. Originally started with company unions, companies busting workers' crumbs and what have you, but, workers built on that and eventually led to, the New Deal and the passage of the Wagner Act. But the lineage of the New Deal and the Wagner Act can be traced directly back to the Ludlow Massacre.
So in looking at this and then looking at these struggles and in these, you know, these massacres, because it's what they were. They were basically going and killing unarmed workers, women and children and families. In looking at this, is it going to take that kind of catastrophe, that kind of tragedy again? Because, you know, I see a lot of the conditions in our country right now, and maybe we're not shooting workers in the back, but, you know, starving them is just as deadly. Do you see a lot of the conditions reverting back to these days?
I mean, I don't know what the catalyst will be to lead to another mass movement back into labor unions like it was during the New Deal, but definitely conditions are not getting better for workers right now. They're getting worse. Employers have been enabled by bad Supreme Court decisions, ineffective labor boards,
and a well orchestrated attack by the very wealthy in this country to once again, as I've been saying, you know, to be able to sit on top of the throne to where robber barons of the past have felt entitled. And, you know, I look at the Koch brothers and I look at the very wealthy today who fund these attack groups, the Alex of the world who pursue this legislation to really steal workers' ability to feed their families and to, well, to share just a little bit. Not want it all, but to share a little bit in the wealth that they create.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, the Heritage Institute that has done a lot of the research and cranked out a lot of this anti-worker drivel, I guess you could call it. Maybe I shouldn't say drivel because it's been effective. Had its genesis in Colorado, the Heritage Institute, funded by the Coors family, which has been big in Colorado and has always led the charge here in Colorado. Actually, the Coors family, members of the Coors family, filed a petition and got an initiative on the ballot back in 2008 for right to work in Colorado, which would be back at the polls. Colorado is an initiative state where you could put stuff like that on the ballot. So anyway, yeah, you mentioned the Copes. We've got the Coors family right here that is at the forefront of that charge to take us back to 1909 and 1914 and maybe even back to 1814. Who knows what their ultimate agenda is.
Well, their ultimate agenda is absolute and total complete control. I mean, if abundant wealth isn't enough, and I look at, you know, Diane Hendricks, the woman who was videotaped with Scott Walker during the uprising there, asking Walker when they were going to bring this euphemistic right to work to Wisconsin, and she was all tingly in the panties and excited. And I would say, you know, what gets a billionaire that excited when there's nothing you can't have. Well, I shouldn't say nothing. What she wants is absolute, complete, total control of everyone and everything. It's that kind of power that they seek.
Sure. Issue like right to work helps them divide workers. And it's just a tactic that leads to their ultimate goal, ultimate control, like you say.
So walk me through this, Mike, because, you know, over the years we've seen these, and the reason we're going on this tour, People's Tour for America, peoplestourforamerica.com, if you want to follow us as we go across the country. The reason that we're out is because we want to go around the country and look at, you know, what were the conditions like for my kids 100 years ago? What were the conditions like for workers 100 years ago? And how did they get better? How did my grandparents' generation grow the largest middle class in the history of civilization? How did they do that? What were the fights? What lessons do we need to learn? Because, unfortunately, as we've been talking about, you know, things seem to me to be reverting back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s, the 1880s and 90s. And how do we fight this stuff back? So, and I think it's important to remember our history, but also remember how things got better and what we did to make those things better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's all organizing and struggle. And like I said before, it never has been easy. It's just gone through cycles. And generally, for the whole living in this country, we've been in a down cycle for a little bit here. But, I mean, there is hope on the horizon, I guess you could say. We've had some successes here in Colorado, unions organizing. We've held our own membership line. So, you know, the key is finding that catalyst, like you say. What will that catalyst be? Who knows? The big catalyst 175 years ago was things like the Ludlow Massacre or whatever. As a way of unifying workers you're all getting killed, I guess. And it led up to New Deal, which was a big trade house, an understanding president, a Supreme Court that had a grip, grasp of the tragedies going on around the country, and that helped catalyze workers into organizing.
Let me ask you, Mike, as executive director of the Colorado AFL-CIO, you know, is this a political thing? Or, you know, because it's my view that, you know, politics come along after we the people take to the streets and we the people demand things. So what has to come first? I mean, I'm of the mindset, I look at fast food workers in major cities across the country taking to the streets saying we want dignity and respect. I'm seeing retail workers. I'm seeing hotel workers. Kathy Youngblood, you know, trying to be on the corporate board of Hyatt. I think, you know, that's what we should be pushing for more than more politics.
Mm-hmm. I think it works hand in glove. You know, if you have success motivating workers and organizing workers, but you've got a political system that's constantly pushing back or being successful pushing back, a lot of those gains can get lost. So I think it works together. You definitely need an organizing model and a social movement going, along with political gains. Having the political leaders that understand and sympathize and support workers in their battle to organize.
So as we continue through your great state, what is it? What should we be seeing? What would you tell my kids? In looking at the history of the state, we want to make sure that kids and workers, that we learn a little bit something as we travel through your state. What are the things that you'd want us to take away?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the takeaway that the need is there for workers to organize. There's no glory, there's no dignity, or little dignity, I guess you'd say, in a workplace where you have no voice. And there's a lot of examples here in Colorado. I'll go back to the Coors Brewery as an example. But it also has to take away that there's hope. And we've had some successes here in Colorado organizing. Workers at the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Denver have organized. The group of security officers of our airport just organized, about 500 of them. The American Federation of Government Employees had success nationwide organizing transport security officers. So I'd ask them to take away to, take the lessons from looking around at what it's like working in a non-union workplace, Walmart, for example. Yeah. There's plenty of Walmarts out here that they could study, they could look at, but also look at the successes too and look there for hope for the future.
And I would add that, looking at the rich and bloody history of your states, the labor wars of the turn of the 19th century and, the Cripple Creeks, the Ludlows, the Columbines, that stuff, that, every struggle had its sacrifice. And every step forward that we workers have had over the centuries has come at the expense of the people before us. And we need to remember that as well. Mike Sherbo,
I agree. If I could just butt back in. Yes, look at the history. And we could very well head back to those times. Who knows where things are going. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of powerful people in this country that wouldn't mind seeing us go back to those times.
And for me, it's about telling our side of the story, not from the Heritage Foundation's point of view and not from the right wing's point of view, but from the people who actually lived it and the people who actually are on our side of this. I see the rewriting of labor's story of, it was something we needed to, back, because there were a couple of bad people. There were these industrialists, these robber barons, who they had absolute control. They had power in the courts. They had power in government. They had the power of the gun. Workers at that time, there was no weekends. There were no eight-hour days. There was no workers' comp. There was no unemployment. There was none of that stuff. And those are the days that they want to take us back to, where there was nothing.
Mm-hmm. And all those gains were fought for. Yep. And blood was spilled to achieve those gains. And who knows? I mean, they get that at the point where blood spilled to hold on to those gains or to regain them or whatever.
Yeah. And I look at what happened in Bangladesh not too long ago as one of those cautionary tales, the canary in the mine, if you will. Because if we allow it to happen in a place like Bangladesh, when's it going to happen here? And, we had gone through West Texas where the explosion happened with the fertilizer plant. We're not too far away from these industrial disasters and this misery and suffering at the hands of the very well-to-do.
Agreed. Simple stuff. And there's people in Bangladesh, there are competition, workers' competition for jobs. The powers that be, guarantee, are looking at Bangladesh as a model, rather than looking at, the textile industry as it was in this country before those jobs went there.
Yeah. Mike, I appreciate the time. Thank you for having us come through your state. I appreciate it.
Hey, Rick, great chatting with you.
Thanks so much. Mike Sherbo, Executive Director of the Colorado AFL-CIO. Quick break as we continue on the People's Tour for America. You can follow us, peoplestourforamerica.com. Right back from the road.
Smith Show, changing America for changing America.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you occurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Are you ready for the Summer of Solidarity Tour? Starting August 17th, a dozen union activists and our friends from across North America will be traveling coast to coast on a 17-day, 14-city road trip, starting in Philadelphia and ending in Los Angeles on Labor Day. Each stop along the way, you're going to be organizing educational events, direct actions, as well as concerts featuring the Oldie All-Stars, legendary singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, and raptivist Michael Fraser O'Brien from Kill the Autocrat. Check out summerofsolidarity.org to find out how you can help connect the grassroots.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America. You can keep connected with us on the tour at peoplestourforamerica.com. Also, therickssmithshow.com. We've got it all there. Follow us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. Tons of opportunities to interact with the program as we're on the tour. You know, in driving across the country, we've seen a number of shuttered factories and really the remnants of a once mighty industrial base. And the question that keeps popping up is, you know, the 2012 election, was it? Who built this? Who built that industrial base that was the most powerful on the history of this planet? To hear some speak, it was the handful of wealthy industrialists and you and me and the other working people of this country, my grandparents' generation. Well, you know, they were just the benefactors of this great vision. I fundamentally disagree with that assessment, which is why I've asked Jim English, former general counsel and former international secretary or treasurer of the United Steelworkers, to come talk with us. Jim, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm happy to do it.
You know, I look at this, and as we move across the country, we see these shuttered plants. We see these factories that were, you know, once the basis of many a prosperous communities and basically just ripped out from under us. And, you know, this idea that, you know, well, these wealthy industrials created this stuff. You know, I got to be honest, I'm struggling to accept, even though that seems to be the mainstream view.
Well, they obviously put some money into it, but they couldn't have done it without the hundreds of thousands of workers that staff these plants, both laborers and skilled tradesmen of various kinds, that really made the
I would argue that, you know, the money that they used, they put some of their own money in, but a lot of it was our money too. Cause, you know, you look at in Washington right now, you look at General Electric, who recently came out and, you know, or it was Apple recently said, well, you know, all those tax breaks, well, we deserve those.
Sure. There was some of their money in, but there was an awful lot of support from the government, and from communities. A lot of those communities gave them tax breaks so that they would set up their facilities there, and they paid low taxes for quite a long period of time.
Yeah, and when you talk about communities, you're really talking about me. You're really talking about our neighbors, us, we the people. And because, you know, a lot of folks I talk to say, well, it's the government. No, the government is, it's us, Jim. It's you. It's me. It's all of our listeners. It's all the people we've met here on the tour.
Sure.
So I guess the question that I have to, that I've been struggling with is, you know, you look at how the country has been almost deindustrialized from the days of Ronald Reagan, who said he wanted to see this country become a service-based economy, which, I don't know, if you look around, I think his vision is pretty well done, don't you think?
Well, it certainly started in that period, but it accelerated dramatically in the 1990s with a series of free trade agreements that that really enabled the capital interests in this country to take their facilities off out of the country and then bring their product back, having used very, very cheap labor. Really,
right.
they basically did what what these industrialists had done in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. They went and found a source of very cheap labor and exploited it.
Well, I mean, you could thank George H.W. Bush and, of course, Bill Clinton for that, with NAFTA and then, you know, GATT, WTO, and all of the other insane trade policies that we've allowed to happen that don't benefit working people at all. I mean, I see no benefit for working people in either country, to be honest with you.
Well, that's right. We in the steelworkers spent a good bit of time working with workers in Mexico and other countries, but Mexico is probably the one that comes to mind most clearly. We made a lot of trips down to the Maquiladora area of northern Mexico, and the conditions that those poor people lived in then and now are really abominable, and a lot of our U.S. companies, or what were U.S. companies, were the ones that were benefiting the most from it.
Yeah, and ultimately, it's these handful of industrialists and the handful of wealthy shareholders who profited, and not the workers. And we were sold this idea that, you know, it was, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, and we were going to all do so much better. Yet instead, we've all done, well, those of us who work for a living have done much worse, while a handful of the globalists, they've done wildly well.
Well, and the other thing that's happened as a result of that has been the environment has suffered substantially. If you look at the environmental conditions that exist in a lot of those areas, there's just no regulation whatsoever, and it kind of brings you back again to what it was like here in this country back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the ravaging that took place of our environment.
I say often on this program, they want to take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Right.
And it's exactly what you're saying. But, you know, one of the questions that I keep wrestling with, and as we talk to people, you know, I keep saying, look, the jobs that are here, we have to make good middle-class family-sustaining jobs with health care, with pensions, and with opportunity, you know, much like my grandparents' generation did with factory jobs and coal mining and truck driving, because I think a lot of people look at, you know, at manufacturing jobs and go, wow, those are good-paying jobs. They weren't always that way.
No, they weren't. If you go back to the first half of the 20th century, they were jobs that people took because they had no other choices, and it wasn't until the labor movement grew in the 1930s and 40s that those jobs started to become very good paying jobs and jobs that that were much safer than they had been.
And how did that happen? I mean, you know, the steelworkers have been one of those unions in history, and even today, who are out in front of this stuff, trying to bring people together. You know, how did that happen? I know there were a bunch of steel strikes, during the 40s and 50s, where, well, 50s and 60s more so than the 40s, but there were a number of steel strikes where people said, you know what, we want a fair share of the wealth we create.
Well, the organization of the manufacturing sector was largely accomplished in the 1930s and 40s, and it was the result of a number of unions that were created that really took off and captured the imagination of workers in that period of time. But it took a struggle. It took another 10, 15 years to get organized, and once organized, then another 15, 20 years to develop contracts with health care, with pensions, with wages that were good wages, and with other fringe benefits, all of the things that my generation kind of took for granted.
Right.
But it was a fight that unions engaged in that time, and unfortunately, it's been a fight that we've had to engage in to an even greater extent. To try to keep what we could keep in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it's the cyclic, it's the cycle. And it seems like we have to refight the same battle over again. And, you know, it's just, well, it's unfortunate. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Jim English, former General Counsel and International Secretary Treasurer of the United Steelworkers Union. You know, Jim, you know, I talk to a lot of people who, you know, as you've said, you know, your generation kind of took those things for granted. And, you know, a lot of folks I talk to today, they think that, you know, the companies that they work for give them these things, this idea, this concept of the benevolent corporation. They just give willingly, without understanding that, you know, the 8-hour day, people actually died for. The idea of having a weekend, people actually died for these things. And, you know, on this tour, what we're trying to do is we're trying to talk to people and remember in every community that, you know what, there was struggle. There were workers taking to the streets and people organizing to say, you know what, we want to make our little corner of the world just a little bit better. And, you know, I'm amazed at the stories that we've come across thus far and the people we've talked to. But are you surprised that we've gotten to this point that we think in terms of, you know, things are just given to us?
Well, let me give you an example of the way I see it. When I started work with the steelworkers as an attorney in their legal department, in the steel industry, the average wage was around $2.50 an hour. That was in 1968. By the 1990s, middle 1990s, the average wage was up around $12 to $15 an hour. Just think about that in percentage terms. That's an enormous increase in the standard of living of workers. Some of that was obtained as a result of strikes and some very bitter strikes. Some of it was accomplished simply because of the threat of a strike. In the steel industry, for example, in the early 1970s, the threat of a strike caused the industry to say, "Hey, look, we'll agree to arbitrate if you'll agree to not strike." And so the steel industry went through a period of about 20 years where that big increase in wages occurred because the unions were able to reap the benefits of the concerns that companies had over the possibility of strike.
And they got a share of their productivity. I mean, the sad reality is that since about 1980, productivity has skyrocketed and wages have been completely decoupled and wages have actually declined over that period.
That's right. Prior to that time, there was a fairly good relationship between productivity and wage growth. But once we hit about 1980, it turned dramatically.
And to me, I mean, that seems to be rational. The more work you do, the more wealth that's created, the more you get to share in it. Unfortunately, the sharing stopped right around the time of Reagan. And I, you know, I hate to be, you know, the guy who says it was Reagan's fault, but I got to be honest, it's kind of coincidental.
Well, it did happen as a result of a pretty serious recession that triggered it in the early 1980s, and it was at that time that companies started to look other places, and imports started to come in, and it's been a struggle ever since that time.
Well, could you argue that it was based on bad policy, bad trade, bad public policy, and decisions made by our leaders, our illustrious leaders?
Well, it clearly was. It was fiscal policy in the 80s, and then it was trade policy in the 90s that really triggered most of it.
So let me ask you this: going back to the strikes of the 50s and 60s, and the wages going up, because the living conditions for many industries went up during that time period as labor had a stronger opportunity to organize and also their productivity gains, them sharing in. You hear this mainstream message that, well, it was the steel workers, it was the strikes, it was the high wages that caused the steel industry to go overseas and to go bankrupt. And, oh, by the way, the 10 weeks vacation everybody got. Where's the mainstream message wrong, do you think?
Well, it's even worse than that. We had a steel worker director who once said, not only do they want us to give back everything we got, but they want us to apologize for ever having had it in the first place. We have us as human beings, I guess we have a tendency to want to blame people who are the victims of bad things that happen.
Yeah. We want to punish people, punish the people who it happened to.
Right, and that's happened here. The focus of so many has been on, oh well, their wages were too high. Well, the focus should have been on the wages of the people that got the jobs. The poor Mexican workers in the northern part of Mexico, the workers in China and other places like that who were just terribly exploited
and still are.
To a great extent still are. That's where the focus should be, not on our economy, any to sort of start this process down in terms of our living conditions. We should be focusing on raising the living conditions of people in other countries.
I agree. We go back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 90s, and there was a robber baron, a railroad magnate of that time, a guy named Jay Gould, and I'm sure you've heard the quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And, I look at all of these divisions and all of this pitting people against one another, and it plays perfectly into that frame. And not that was new then, and it's not certainly not new now, but it is the MO.
And it's interesting that if you talk to workers who were still alive, who experienced the big organizing trends of the 40s, so the 30s and the 40s, what I think they'll tell you is that there was just this common, sudden realization on their part that if everybody, tied their fates to everybody else, we could accomplish tremendous things. That really was
the World War II generation.
The labor movement. And it's when that gets broken apart. Suffering that's happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think of my grandparents' generation, the World War II generation, and they definitely had that sense of being one community, as where, my generation was beaten into us, that we're individuals.
Yes.
And that we don't need each other and we could go it alone and, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, this whole Horatio Alger vision of ourselves.
That's exactly right. And that's the vision that we've had to compete with, and it's kind of when people have that vision, they think of working in unity with other people as sort of a sense of weakness, when in fact it's an indication of strength.
Yeah, well, we hear everyone say, well, if you're talking about anything having to do with community or people working together, it's socialism or it's communism or any of that nonsense.
That's right, and we're suffering from that now in so many ways, and we've got to find a way to get that sense of community and that sense of unity back into our culture.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Jim. Last line of questioning I've got for you. And it is, you know, where do we go to the future? What lessons from the past do we need to learn? Do we need to know so we don't have to relearn things the hard way? Because my grandfather always told me, you know, I'm telling you something so you don't have to make the same mistake I made. Don't be stupid and do the same thing I did. Learn from what I'm telling you, not from what you're going to have to get hit. If you get hit in the head with a 2x4, it hurts. I've told you. You don't have to go through it. So what from our past should we should we know moving forward?
Well, I think that the first thing that we have to understand very profoundly is that as long as there are groups of people in the world that have it really bad, we're all in danger.
Yep.
We've got to focus on trying to raise all boats. That's not something that happens automatically. It's not something that happens as a result of our free trade or free market system. It happens in spite of that system, and what it means is that we as a society, labor unions, environmentalists, have to all work together to try to improve those conditions wherever they are, so that we can improve our conditions as well.
Yeah, the old labor concept of an injury to one is an injury to all.
Exactly.
And it's something, you know, after Bangladesh, after the 1,127 workers there in Bangladesh were killed because the building they went to work in one day collapsed on them because they had no building codes, and the person that owned the building said, let's slap a couple extra floors on it. That's no big deal. 1,127 people dead. And we're telling people, look, you know, eventually, you know, that's our past. Do we have to go back to that?
And you don't have to go back that far in our history to see the same kinds of disasters. If you go back to New York in the early 1900s and the Triangle Shirt Factory,
right,
fires and things of that kind.
Yeah, the hope is that we learn the lesson, we move forward. Jim English, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Good talking to you.
Thanks so much. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, the People's Tour for America. If you want to follow us on the tour, you can go to peoplestourforamerica.com. Where we've been, where we're going, what we're doing. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's desperate times, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out.
Where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments. Members under company surveillance. Public divided either than rubber saw they hate it. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account
that we never give up.
We'll be here.
Radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers in China held a U.S. businessman in captivity until he reached a compensation agreement for employees concerned that they may be displaced when some jobs are moved to India. Specialty Medical Supplies co-owner Chip Starnes was blocked from leaving when workers became concerned that they may not be fairly compensated if they're laid off. Starnes was allowed to leave after he reached an agreement with a union negotiator. Starnes has said the company wasn't planning to lay off many of the workers who fall under the agreed-to package and told the Associated Press that he'd be rehiring some workers who had been previously let go. A new website is seeking to provide workers with the tools they need to create changes in their workplace. Coworker.org is a petition site that allows workers to build support as they endeavor to create a positive environment on the job. Jess Kutch is one of the co-founders of Coworker.org and provide an example of one way the site is being used successfully.
We have about 12 campaigns running on the site. We're really excited about a campaign that's running right now by Capital Bike Share employees. Capital Bike Share is DC's bike share program, and the employees there believe that they're owed more than $100,000 in back pay, as well as health and welfare benefits from the company. So they launched a petition. They've gotten a ton of local support, and they also got media coverage from outlets all over the country. And this week the company responded and said they're working to rectify the problem very quickly.
The site was inspired by the success Kutch saw with consumer petitions putting pressure on companies.
Workers need more support than a 17-year-old who's trying to ban plastic bags in her town. When you're going up against your boss, you're taking on a lot of risk, and there's a lot at stake. So coworker.org is really committed to figuring out what kinds of support workers need to win these campaigns.
While the site is still in beta, the team behind coworker.org are putting together resources that will help inform workers about their rights in the workplace and how to appropriately cope with an employer who may push back against the petition campaign. Macy's has agreed to pay $175,000 after a federal investigation determined the retail chain had discriminated against immigrant employees. The fine includes a $100,000 fund that will compensate the workers who had been unfairly terminated, suspended, or punished. Under the settlement, Macy's denied its practices were discriminatory or unfair. While details of the investigation weren't made available to the public, the Department of Justice said the company used unfair documentary practices.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America on the road in Denver, Colorado. If you want to follow where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. If you missed any portion of our program or any of the tour dates that we've had thus far, you can get the podcast at thericksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com. Pat, you know, I looked in talking with the guy who's the state director or the state historian, the director of the History Colorado Center. You know, you look at this building and you look at the exhibits and it's just really at its infancy. They're growing and there are more things they're going to be doing. I wish we could have spent the whole day there.
Yeah, especially with the donor list. I would like to have picked that apart for a while. You know, and the only thing about that is, you know, when somebody's paying for you to keep track of history, highlight some things, other things not so much.
But I got to be honest, there were some things in there you go, if I'm paying to rewrite history, how'd that get in there?
Yeah, well, I definitely think, I mean, I think that the fella, the chief historian for the state of Colorado's integrity is unimpeachable.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm sure he's hauling butt trying to make sure that he gets the stuff in there that people need to know about. But it still, you know, I mean, even just my bag from Crater Lake that's paid for by the people they hoard the National Park Service out to. You know, I mean, everything is extra or whatever, you know. So you're wondering just how... I would say I'm totally a Marxist. And if you read the Communist Manifesto, he never advocated violence, as you know. I'm sure you've read it. What he said was, if we don't temper capitalism, we're going to have violence. If it's unbridled capitalism, what you're going to get is violence. If you steal the work from the laborer, eventually the laborer is going to say, you know what? I can use these muscles for other things.
There's only so much of you know what we're willing to eat. And
right.
Eventually you get full.
And so what Karl Marx recommended was sharing the wealth with the labor class that makes the wealth, or you're going to have violence. And when the guys from the French Revolution called him up and said, hey, can you come down here? You know, because there were many French Revolutions. It wasn't 1789 because he wrote in 1848, right? But when they brought him down for like their fifth revolution and they said, can you help us? He said, I will not advocate for violence. I cannot help you. Right? Now, nobody tells that story of Karl Marx. They think he's, you know, whatever Stalin was, right? But we can say if Stalin enforced communism on people, guess what? The United States of America has enforced capitalism with plenty of violence, right?
Yep.
And the only reason, as Roosevelt, FDR proved, the only reason that this country succeeds will be if we temper capitalism with socialism. social reforms with the quote-unquote unbridled greed. And so I guess maybe that's what the National Park Service is. I don't know. I'm going to be doing a lot of research on that and digging into it, because there's an awful lot of private money swimming around our national parks.
But, you know, and to highlight what you just said, I mean, you look at Ludlow, you look at Columbine, you look at a lot of these places where we've seen these mine owners, these robber barons using the power of the state gun to oppress and to put down any uprising of workers saying, hey, you know, we'd like a little bit of something.
Can I show my ignorance now and ask you to explain Columbine? Because I think most people think Columbine, they think the shooting the kids did at the school.
No, the Columbine massacre, that happened. Right. You know, so, back around the same time Ludlow happened, a little couple years after.
And that was?
About 100 years ago. In fact, okay. Ludlow is going to be 100 years this fall.
Okay.
So, but you're talking about when, you know, the mines were...
So Columbine had mines that had workers in them that also went into...
Right. And we talked a bit about that with the state director who pointed out that, you know, this was another example of, you know, the mine workers saying, hey, you know, we want to be able to make a decent wage. Not just that.
We don't want to die at work. Yeah.
More the working conditions, and you know, we don't want to have to buy with company script. It's the same story over and over, you know, across Pennsylvania, across Indiana, across, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, here in the Colorado. It's all the same story where workers are saying, you know what? You hold the keys to our existence. Mm-hmm. And I go back to the guy I knew a couple of years back who, you know, when he came back from Vietnam, he paid off the debt that his family had incurred to the company store. And that was, you know, in the early 70s.
That was Vietnam.
Yeah.
That wasn't the Civil War.
And that's the, you know, that's the amazing thing. His family had always been in debt to the store. Mm-hmm. And...
Well, then I guess that's the model George Bush used for student loans then. You know, when he stopped having the National Direct Student Loan and had the National Guaranteed Student Loan,
yeah.
That was a big difference, because rather than the loans coming from the federal government through banks, they were loans that the government said, hey, we'll make good on them, basically by garnishing your income taxes for the rest of your life. But in the meantime, here's the private banker. We're going to put him between a kid and an education.
Yeah, and is company script any different today than it was then? I mean, they give us credit cards and they give us student mm-hmm. loans, and we're still in debt.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is now we have the illusion that we have choice.
Yeah. Well, you watch those Zeitgeist videos about the fact that the money doesn't really exist, that it's all numbers in the atmosphere, you know, and that's true. I mean, our paper money, ever since we took it off the gold and silver standards, it has no actual value. No value. And if you find a silver certificate in your grandpa's drawer, grab it.
Yeah.
You know? Because the money is completely based on faith. There's nothing backing it up. What are they doing with the money at Fort Knox then, with all that gold?
Maybe it doesn't exist.
Oh, great. You gave me another thing to keep me up.
There you
night.
Go. Now you have something else to worry about.
Ugh.
But no, I go back to this. And you know, in looking at the Columbine massacre and looking at the Ludlow massacre, where, you know, the companies wanted to put down the workers and force them back to work. It's not even, and this is the part that blows my mind, it's not even that these workers said, we're not doing the job anymore. It's, no, you have to go back to work, and we're going to put this gun to your back to make you go back to work.
And they talk about Stalin. Really?
No, but you know,
that's exactly
say,
what
if
happened.
If you don't want to do it, don't do it. Well, these guys are saying, we're not doing it. And they're sending out the militia to say, no, you're going to do it. And you're going to do it for poverty wages and in horrible conditions. And, oh, by the way, if you die or get hurt on the job, you're out then.
And so is your family, unless we can talk your wife into being the concubine of the manager, or unless we can get your 8-year-old in there.
Yeah, I think back a book I read, I think it was called King Cole, where at the end of it they had on the guy's tombstone, where it said, you know, 40 years I worked with pick and shovel in the mines. And basically now I'm dead and I'm, you know, now I'm free.
Yeah.
You know, and the sad reality is for a lot of them, that was the only way you got out of that.
Well, and you talked about those prison laborers that they used when they couldn't have slaves anymore. And the prison laborers said the only way out of this is to kill yourself.
Severely maim yourself.
Yeah. But then you'd be severely maimed. You know, where... I think they were just thinking, get me out of here. I'm a prisoner and I'm put into this. And this is the history of the United States. And, you know, we're not bringing it up to be a buzzkill. It ain't that we want to, like, wreck your day.
No,
oh, my God.
Depressing.
I listened to the Rick Smith Show, and now I want to go cut my wrists. You know, no, that's not why we're doing it. We're doing it because you're getting lied to. Turn on Fox News. You want to hear a lie? Turn on Fox News. You want to hear a lie? Open up half the newspapers in this country. And those lies are stopping us from actually caring about each other as people in the United States and understanding that our lives will improve if we work together. Our lives will get better if we work together. They want to isolate us, every one of us against themselves and against themselves and against each other.
But what I thought was fascinating in talking with the state director there is, you know, the Cripple Creek massacre that happened and the strike that went on there. That the governor, you know, for the first time, had actually called out the National Guard to protect the striking workers.
And he was gone in the next election.
Well, of course he was. But you know, the thing that he said that caught my attention is once you use the power of government, the power of we the people to help workers, their conditions got infinitely better. And that was the key to what he said is, you know what, they did better. And that's where I think FDR said, you know what, we're going to give workers the ability to organize because they have no power when it comes to the workplace. The employers have all of the power, and I've laid that out in the past. You know, they just set the wages, they set the hours, they set the conditions, they set whether you're going to take a break, when you're going to take a break, all of that stuff. They set all of that. The only right a worker has is the right to fold their arms and say no.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back to, you know, to this period with Ludlow and the, you didn't even have that.
Right, because it beat you in the head until you went back to work. You know, if you look at John Adams especially and Ben Franklin and the guys who crafted the Constitution, which really was written to protect slavery and to protect the landowning class, let's just face it. Even though that's what it was written for, John Adams and Ben Franklin and those guys pressed for the fact, and it's in your Constitution, that the United States Army, military and army together, United States military could never be used against the citizenry. Never. It's in the Constitution. It's against the Constitution. That's why they use the militia. That's why they use the National Guard. And the few times the Army has been called out, even the Supreme Court, and in some of its lamest days, has said that was against the Constitution. So they do an end run around the Constitution and send the National Guard after you. It's just, and it's wrong. It's wrong on every level. And it's what happened in our history, just like slavery was wrong, and just like, you know, taking the land from the Indians was wrong. And until we get used to the fact that it's wrong, we're not going to get used to the fact that we can be better.
Yeah. And, you know, to highlight the life, liberty, pursuit of property was the first draft.
I know.
Happiness was later. I like happiness better.
I like happiness, too. It's super, not too bad. It's on health.
I think that should be life. I think that's what they meant, life.
Yeah, that should be part of happiness also. How can you be happy when you're not healthy?
Well, we don't care about you. I'll be happy. I'll be happy when you're not healthy because I can make profit off it.
Yeah, isn't that awful?
Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show on the road, the People's Tour for America here in Denver, Colorado. Quick break, right back.
America for the better.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
When you get to the top of the throne, lock off each end of the Rick. Watch it, Rick Smith. You can't kill.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America has found its way all the way to Denver, Colorado, our latest stop on the Labor History Tour. And, Pat, I got to tell you, you know, going through the Rockies, coming out of Wyoming, just again, more beauty, more amazing scenery.
I was just going to say, we were in Wyoming, but we were.
Yeah. And Dick Cheney didn't even come after you.
I was looking for him. That's why I went into Cheyenne. And then I remembered he never lived in Wyoming. That was a little game they played because he actually lived in the same state as the man running for president, and they had to change that because it's against the law.
What an amazing little state capital.
It was so small, wasn't it? You know what it reminded me of, and I think you've been there, is Montpelier, Vermont.
Yeah.
You know, except that it's not hilly, but the same sort of, like, there were five buildings, the cute little Main Street, and other than that,
you know, you go by some of the lobbyists You know, in our area, there are these big palatial, huge buildings. You know, the Bar Association and the Chamber had little tiny houses, which I just thought were adorable.
Well, the same in Salt Lake City. Remember all those big mansions leading up to the... Those are all privately owned.
Anyway, the tour has led us to Denver, the capital of Colorado. And I'm sitting here with William Convery. He is the state historian and director of exhibits and interpretation here at the History Colorado Center. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you. Welcome to Colorado.
We appreciate you having us. You know, as we're doing this tour, we're discovering so much that we weren't taught in school, so much that's not in the mainstream media, so much of our past that's not only been forgotten, but I believe been systematically dismantled and destroyed so that we never knew it ever existed.
Yeah, so, you know, it's one of the big themes of the West is that there are these ethnic divisions between Indians and non-Indians, between newer immigrants and later immigrant groups who come in, and you know, those get exploited sometimes for different kinds of purposes. So, you know, the extermination and expulsion of Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians at Sand Creek is really designed to, you know, expedite settlement, to get more people, non-Indians, into Colorado. Certainly as laboring groups began to come into Colorado, older immigrant groups would band together. Some of the first labor unions in Colorado were formed by Irish and Welsh and Cornish miners against Italian miners and Greek miners who were coming in. And that kind of competition is always, you know, a ripe place for capitalists to play.
Yeah, and you know, I use this quote a lot, and you know, my listeners, they've heard it a million times, and I know Pat, you've heard it, but Jay Gould said, you know, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half, and you know, it is these divisions where that lies.
Yeah, so you know, it's funny you should mention Jay Gould. He was really involved with bringing railroads into Colorado, and you know, using them as playing cards to keep growing his wealth. But you know, he brought in the Chinese to work on the Union Pacific line and other lines. The first Chinese arrive in Colorado. They very quickly become successful here. They branch out into mining, but they were very resented in Colorado as well as in Wyoming. And Denver itself experienced its own anti-Chinese riot in 1880, when Denverites busted into downtown Denver's Chinatown district and burned it out and expelled the Chinese, killed one man, beat up several other Chinese, and you know, really paved the way to if not totally expelling the Chinese, to containing them in one place. And making them less of an economic threat.
Yeah, under the guise of, you know, they took our jobs, or that's ours.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the law here is, in many places in the West, is the Chinese weren't allowed to mine in mining regions that whites still found profitable, yet the Chinese worked very hard and managed to make a living and set up businesses in places like Denver, and they were resented for that, as well as for their, you know, perceived otherness, the fact that they didn't fit into the customs and the norms of the rest of Colorado.
Yeah, it's always the others. You know, one of the things that, you know, as I've done my research in labor history, you know, the big thing here is obviously is Ludlow. You know, most people, if they know anything about labor history, it's always Ludlow.
Yeah. Yeah, so historians think of Ludlow as the end of 30 years of labor conflict in Colorado in the mining regions, first with gold and silver mines and groups like the Western Federation of Miners arguing for an eight-hour day or for a minimum $3 a day wage. But by the 19-teens, the major mining industry in Colorado was centered around coal. And the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company was employed more than 15,000 laborers, either in coal mines or running coke ovens or operating the huge steel smelter down in Pueblo, Colorado. And when the United Mine Workers of America came in, they were really looking for union recognition, but mostly they were asking for enforcement of safety laws that were already on the books in Colorado, but were simply ignored by the companies and by the state of Colorado. Mining coal was, there was no more dangerous place to mine coal than Colorado in the early 20th
Why is
century.
That?
In about 20 years, more than 3,500 miners died in Colorado alone, some in major accidents that killed dozens or hundreds of miners, but mostly in small accidents that picked off one or two miners at a time, a coal seam bursting out and shooting projectiles at bullet speed, or a small explosion that kills one miner. And part of the reason for this was that miners were not compensated to do the safety measures in order to make their rooms safe. They were only compensated for producing coal, which meant that they would cut corners. They would not lay track, or they wouldn't clear out their escape passages, or they would They would try to get a little extra coal out of an unsafe seam in order to produce what they needed to make to support their families.
And when was this?
So coal mining really begins in Colorado in the 1870s and 1880s. The Great Coal Strike took place in the fall of 1913. And it culminated in the Ludlow Massacre of April 20th, 1914.
Yeah, because what you were saying, you know, doing the safety stuff doesn't pay. Yeah. You know, immediately when you said that, I'm thinking of Don Blankenship and the Upper Big Branch mine just recently, where there's a memo written in his hand saying, we don't get paid for safety. We don't get we only get paid to run coal. And I'm going, you know, that was 100 years ago we're talking about. He just said this recently within the last decade or two.
Yeah, I mean... coal mining has become more safe. If you look at all of the statistics, part of it had to do with the mechanization of coal mining, taking, you know, the pick and shovel method of coal mining and moving it to mechanization. But a lot of the same labor and safety issues that inflicted coal mines 100 years ago are still true today. And not just in the United States. You look at coal mining in China and other developing countries. There's still that desire to produce more and make more profit in conflict with human safety.
Well, that's your basic capitalism, profit over people.
Right.
You know, as my grandfather, the tank was important. Mm-hmm. They would sacrifice you instead of the tank because they could replace you.
Well, that's what's so funny. You should say that. The coal miners had a saying that the mules were more valuable than the miners. If there was an accident, the first thing the foreman would do is say, how many mules did we lose? Because it cost money to replace the mules, but there were always more workers who were willing to come in and work in the mines.
Not much has changed today in my view. And you said something a couple of minutes ago that caught my attention. They were fighting for an eight-hour day. Mm-hmm. They were fighting for a basic minimum wage. Mm-hmm. They were fighting for safety. And, you know, I talk to so many people now who think, you know, these things are just given to us.
Yeah.
The benevolent corporation so wonderfully gives us these things out of the goodness of their heart. And, you know, the Ludlow is a story of it's a massacre for a reason.
Yeah, so... what actually happened at Ludlow is the Colorado National Guard, after 6 months of a very tense coal mining strike in southern Colorado, attacked a United Mine Workers tent colony. The workers had been evicted from their company houses, and the UMAW was subsidizing them, helping them, providing them shelter out on the plains in these tent camps.
UMAW?
The United Mine Workers of America. And the National Guard, many of whom were actually receiving two paychecks, one from the state of Colorado, one from the mine owners as camp guards and mercenaries, went in and flushed out the camp. They were looking for weapons of mass destruction. The miners were rumored, and it was very true. They were stockpiling weapons underneath the cell in the cellars of the tents, but the cellars were also places for the families to go when shooting broke out. And when shooting did break out, a gunfight took place on April 20th, the day after Greek Easter. A family went into one of the cellars for protection. When the strikers were driven out of the camp, the National Guard came in and began burning down the tents. And 11 children and two women were asphyxiated underneath one of the tents. At the same time, an 11-year-old boy named Frank Snyder was hiding, but he had to get out to get water. Some stories say he had to go to the bathroom, and he got shot in the head. The leader of the workers at Ludlow, a man named Louis Tikas, a Greek miner, was shot in the back. He was hit in the head with a rifle butt in order to run away and was gunned down. It was a massacre in that sense. And it created the largest period of civil unrest, the deadliest civil unrest in the United States since the Civil War. The miners took to the hills and began attacking company towns and mines, attacking mine guards and superintendents, attacking the National Guard. More than 50 people died in a period of 10 days, and ultimately Woodrow Wilson had to bring in the federal troops in order to disarm everyone and stop the violence.
Now, you listen to this and you go, why isn't this not taught in school? Why is this something we don't hear about?
You know what I find, chilling about the whole thing is, we as Americans, or we as people of the United States, I prefer to say, because America's got Canada and Mexico and, you know, Venezuela and stuff in it, but we believe that they'll kill somebody else, but they won't kill us. You know, we'll kill the kids in Iraq, we'll kill people in Afghanistan, we won't kill our own, you know, and that's not having people know these stories keeps that mythology going.
Well,
and we can even swallow the fact that that for oil or whatever people think these wars are for, will kill somebody else's kids. But the fact that they'll put a bullet into a 12-year-old's kid for stuff here, that's the history that's not told, and it's important that it's not told.
Well, you know, William, you know, we were in Wisconsin for the uprising back in February of 2011. And one of the things that caught my attention were the grad assistants who had led the occupation were saying, you know, we heard the governor say we're calling out the National Guard.
Yeah.
And they hearkened back to their labor education because Wisconsin's one of the few states in the country that has any labor education component to it. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, governor calling out the National Guard, red flags.
Yeah. I like to think of the National Guard as a benevolent force. They go help people in tornadoes or in floods or hurricanes. But on the other hand, they serve the interests and power, and they can be used as a tool for good or for evil. You know, you don't have to look back to Ludlow. Kent State is another example of when the National Guard is called out to protect a status quo.
And when you have a corporate Supreme Court, and, you know, I go back to the governor here at the time, Peabody, went to the Supreme Court. I think it was Moyer versus Peabody, where it said the governor can call out the National Guard to put down insurrection. You know, when those people decide that they've had enough.
Yeah, and interesting that you call it an insurrection. I think what allowed something like Ludlow to happen or other violent mining camp strikes, such as the Cripple Creek strike of 1903 and 1904, is it was very easy for the corporations and for state authorities to think of miners as somebody other than Americans in many ways. They deliberately brought in immigrants in part to keep the miners from coalescing and organizing. The CFNI, just to give one example, printed their corporate regulations in 27 different languages. And you can think of miners as, well, you're not really Americans, you don't really belong here. It's the same kind of justification for something like Sand Creek. You can say, well, this person isn't like me, so we can treat them how we want.
Interesting. And in
the Japanese internment camps or any. Yeah. Real quickly, the National Guard was called out for Katrina. And when I was down in Katrina as a journalist, they didn't send Louisiana National Guard. They sent the Kentucky National Guard. They sent another state. And I'll tell you what, they were brutal. You didn't step out of line in front of that. So it's not, you don't have to even go back as far as Kent State.
Yeah. Right. And the other part of the Moyer versus Peabody thing is suspended habeas corpus.
Right.
Which, you know, I'm thinking back to, you know, the Bush years and thinking back to a lot as history repeats itself.
You know what the adjutant general, the head of the National Guard, said during the WFM strike in 1903-1904, the Western Federation of Miners strike, was when they said he needed to prove habeas corpus. He was rounding up newspaper editors and putting them in a bullpen for speaking out against the companies, and somebody said, you need habeas corpus, and he said, habeas corpus, I'll give them postmortems, was his answer.
Now, you know, you listen to that.
This was the adjutant general of the National Guard?
Yeah, in the Cripple Creek strike of 1903.
Now we don't have to have that problem because the newspapers are owned by the corporation, so we don't have to worry so much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and bringing back to this, because, you know, you look at this history and is there any part of this labor history in the History Center here?
Yeah, we have an exhibit about the Sand Creek Massacre that we're doing some consultation on with the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes right now. We have a story about silver miners in Silverton and the challenges they face, the difficulties they face, but the pride and the skill that they had in order to do their job safely and well. We're also developing an exhibit about the Ludlow Massacre called The Children of Ludlow, which will open at our El Pueblo Museum in Pueblo in September of this year, in time for the 100th anniversary of the coal strike.
I'd like to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I want to talk about that.
Okay.
The kids and the families. And
yeah.
What was life like for an 11-year-old? What was life like for families back during this time period? Because it's my fear we're heading right back to that. I'm going to take a quick break. We're here from Denver, the People's Tour for America. We're here with William Convoy. He is the state historian and director of exhibits here at the History Colorado Center. Quick break, right back.
The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate.
Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, reaching out from the red. Father Sharp left a cameo, blue dental, had his vape.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any portion of the program, the podcast's right there. Also, you can get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You can follow us, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. See where we've been, where we're going today. We are in Denver, Colorado, the History Colorado Center. I'm sitting here with William Convery. He's the state historian and director of exhibits and interpretation here at the History Colorado Center. Bill, thanks for sticking around.
I'm so glad to be here.
You know, you go back and you listen to the history, and, you know, to me, so much of it has repetitive themes. Mm-hmm. We keep relearning the same thing over and over and over again, and it seems to me we're heading back in that same direction, only hopefully not as bloody and as nasty as what you've laid out.
Yeah, you know, Mark Twain said, history never repeats itself, but sometimes it rhymes. That's the way I think of it. It's there are patterns in history, and if we pay attention to them carefully, we can make better informed decisions about today and tomorrow. That's the reason to be aware of history and know how things have happened in the past. It's our social memory.
Yeah, so we can see it coming around the bend when it happens
right.
Again. And, you know, a couple of years back, I took a tour of a mine site up in Lackawanna County, uh-huh. And I was volunteering as a big brother at the time. We went down, the kid was 8 at the time,
mm-hmm.
And we went down and we saw displays of all the people who were there. And this 8-year-old kid that I was with walked up to one of the little mannequin dolls and looked, this is me,
yeah.
And identified with the kid who was opening and closing
yeah,
the door.
Right,
and when he hurts, yeah,
mm-hmm.
50% fatality rate.
Yeah.
Of that six, eight-year-old kid.
Okay, so explain what he's talking about.
Yeah, so kids in the coal fields and the mines grew up really fast. They went into the mines. Maybe they quit school in third or fourth or fifth grade. And they went straight to work. And one of the first jobs that kids in coal mines would get were called trappers. And their job was to open and close the doors to the mine to let the mule carts out with the ore. And then they would graduate from there to become sorters, where they would stand on conveyor belts and pick rocks or non-productive minerals out of the coal or the gold and silver ore. And from there they would go on and become miners themselves. So 8, 9, 10-year-old kids, boys mostly, are going into the mines, giving up their education and starting to work. And they worked as hard, they died as frequently, they suffered from the same kind of illnesses and ailments as other miners. So they had something at stake in the great coal field strike of 1913-14. boys and girls marched in the picket lines because not only were they supporting their families, but literally their own health and welfare was at stake.
And a lot of it, you know, these kids, you know, and I have 11, a 7, and a 4-year-old. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think of, you know, what if it's 100 years ago and I'm one of these miners? What's the future of my family? What happens if something happens to me? And, mm-hmm. you know, we've heard the stories of, you know, of miners killed in the mine. The supervisor, yeah. you know, takes them home and literally throws mm-hmm. the body at the door
yeah.
to let the family know, yeah, here's your eviction notice.
We have stories of people who were evicted immediately after a husband, a breadwinner was killed in the mine, or even injured once their productive capacity was through. There was no workers' compensation. There was no social safety net for them at all. Even for miners killed, in Colorado, the law was that companies were liable if a coroner's jury determined that the fault lay with the company. But unsurprisingly, that almost never happened. Almost never happened. It was always with the fault of the miners who were, you know, the fiction was is they were independent contractors.
Yep.
And so they assumed their own risk and their own liability.
Like FedEx. Independent contractors, right?
Yeah, good point.
Exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, part of this tour that we're going on is, you know, me wanting my children to hear the stories. What would their lives have been like? And,
yeah.
and you know, it, what's the old, I forget, the Brutish and Short, you know.
Nasty Brutish and Short.
Right.
And you think about that, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids in the mines, 50% fatality rate, and we easily forget that stuff.
Yeah, you know, it is. And at the same time, the companies 100 years ago were working so hard to acculturate kids to the idea that they would grow up to be the next generation of miners. So the schools focus very much on Americanization programs and the idea of individualism and capitalism, and that these are the values that Americans stand for, and set the boys up to be the next generation
workers,
of miners,
sure.
and the girls to be the next generation of producers, of producing families and taking care of their families. And you know, they were given, you know, Americanized values with the hope that this would keep them docile and in the workforce moving forward. They
you
didn't
know,
have a lot of opportunities.
And when you hear that, you know, I look at our education system today, and, you know Pat, you know, as I'm looking at this, it's the same themes. We need to train the next generation of workers. We need more job training programs instead of education being for critical thinkers.
Absolutely not. Education is a big impediment to being able to get somebody to go to work at 8. But you say they give up their education. They also give up their childhood. I mean, their childhood's got a value. The other thing that your coroner's inquiries made me think of was another April 20th, which is when the big explosion happened in the Gulf of Mexico and began the BP oil spill that went on forever. And sure, they decided
killed.
Who was to blame after those 11 workers were dead.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly the case April 20th, that's a funny date, isn't it? That's also the day of the Columbine High School.
It's the day that Hitler was born, and it's the day Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City.
And April 18th, just this past year, is when the West Texas explosion happened. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about April. It's interesting you brought up Columbine, though.
Get rid of the month.
You know, when we think about Columbine, we think about the school shooting, but there was also another shooting and a massacre there as well.
At Columbine?
Yeah.
Are you thinking of the Columbine mine? Yes,
sure.
Right. So one of the mainstream, one of the ways that Ludlow...
Good segue.
Yeah, one of the ways that Ludlow always gets interpreted is that because of the sacrifices of these miners, things got better, but they really didn't get better right away. And by the 1920s, the United Mine Workers and coal miners in the northern coal fields of Boulder County around Louisville and Lafayette went on strike for many of the same reasons, the same safety issues and the same recognition of union issues that had brought miners in the southern coal fields out on strike in the 19-teens. And that, again, led to violence as private detectives and mine guards and the National Guard were called out really to protect the property rights of the owners. And it led to shooting as well at the at a mine in Lafayette, at the Columbine mine. So there's this kind of strange parallel between what happened at the Columbine shooting of 1927 versus the one of 12 or so years ago.
Right. There was one other one that, you know, pops into my mind. That's the Cripple Creek massacre. But a little different scenario there. What's the difference between, you know, the Ludlow and the Columbine with Cripple Creek?
So if this is what you're talking about, there was a bomb set off at the depot in Victor. I'm not sure this is what you're referring to, but there there were strike breakers assembled at a depot in Victor, Colorado, and an explosion was set off, and I think 8 of the strike breakers were killed at that. And that's really what set off the National Guard and got them working on the or starting to round up newspaper editors and literally round up strikers and put them on rail cars and send them out to the Kansas or New Mexico border and dump them out on the border. And it was the person who was accused of that bombing was Harry Orchard, a Western Federation of Miners strongman, really, who was accused, along with Big Bill Haywood, later of assassinating the governor of Idaho. So, you know, it led to a really extreme crackdown, this act of violence, and made sure that undermined the miners' cause in a lot of ways, because after that, the National Guard just had license to go in and break up the unions.
Now, was that really an explosion caused by somebody, or is this sort of similar to the battleship Maine where the engine blew up but they blamed it on?
I think in this case they actually had evidence that there was a bomb that was set off. It was a bitter and ugly and nasty strike, and both sides were willing to use violence to advance their ends. The difference is that the mine owners had state-supported violence on their side, so ultimately they were going to have the leverage, the apparatus of law and order, that would allow them to break the law when they needed to in order to meet their ends.
Now, this was a time when nobody ever made the connection that all this land was only in the holdings of these huge companies because they'd stolen it from the Indians. I mean, nobody ever made that connection, right, that they're only property owners because of thievery.
Right. Well, you know, we were past that point. By 1900, the Cheyennes and Arapahoes had been driven completely out of the state. The Ute Indian tribes had either been driven into reservations in Utah or forced down into a strip of land in the southwest corner of Colorado. And their land had been systematically stripped away with them through coercive treaties or through outright theft in some cases. It was legal because there were treaties that had been signed, but they were often signed by people like Urey of the Utes, who was appointed by the government to be the spokesman of the tribes, but certainly didn't have the consensus of tribal leaders. So it had the form of legality, but a land steal by any other name, I guess, right?
It's kind of like the treaty in Tennessee we were talking about as we began this trip, where the Republican representative came down to sign the treaty with the workers that were killed, you know, 122 years ago.
Signing a treaty with dead people is really a clever thing that the United States government's been able
but
to.
But the reason I
consensus, that's one way to get it, right? Yeah. You know,
anyone against it, raise your hand.
Some of the treaties that the Utes were forced to sign were literally coercive treaties. They weren't treaties; they were ultimatums. It's take it or
bang,
or you're going to war, and there are only 3,500 of you in all of the West. So good luck with that, right? So, Urey did it because he wanted to protect his people. He didn't like it any better than anyone else.
But the reason I brought up Cripple Creek is because, you know, with the other two, the Columbine and the Ludlow, that was, you know, the National Guard, that was the Colorado Rangers. Mm-hmm. The government sent out them to protect the companies. Mm-hmm. As you had said earlier, we talked Cripple Creek was different because the governor actually sent out the National Guard.
Yeah. Okay, so here's how the National Guard is, you know, it's a tool of the people in power. It can be used for good. It can be used for evil. In 1893, the miners in Cripple Creek went on a strike, the gold and silver miners under the Western Federation of Miners. 8-hour day was at issue. The minimum wage was at issue. Recognition of the union was certainly at issue. In the past, miners had not had much success in getting the terms that they wanted during labor controversies because the National Guard could always be called out on behalf of the mine owners. In 1893, however, Colorado's governor was a populist named Davis Wade. He was a newspaper editor from Aspen who rode in on a wave of free silver, the big monetary issue of the late 19th century. But when he came in, he had very different views about how to use power to support interest. And when the strike took place, Wade sent in the National Guard to protect the rights of the strikers to strike and to prevent strike breakers from coming in and taking their jobs.
I'm sure he wasn't around long.
Well, yeah, the strike ended quickly and on very favorable terms to the miner, but in the very next election, business interests banded together and they made sure that Davis Wade didn't have a second term in office.
You know, they need that right now in Portland, Oregon, and in Vancouver, Washington, where those poor people who've been locked out of their jobs are just, you know, too bad, so sad, too bad. If you're listening to the show and you want to help them, by the way, there's a place you can go right on the website. You can click that link and that letter will go not only to your congressperson to say stop the lockout, but also to the President of the United States. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm sure he would care.
Now, I'm fascinated by you, just to be quite frank, but don't worry, I'm leaving town. but when you decided to become an historian and then probably didn't figure you'd become the state historian, although who knows, did you say, I'm going to have to learn all this stuff about labor unions and about strikes to know anything about Colorado, or did this just sort of evolve in your understanding?
That's a great question, and I think if you study the history of Colorado or the West, it's essential you understand the labor controversies that took place here, because Colorado, for the first third of its existence as a territory and a state, was a colony. It was an extractive economy where we didn't manufacture, but we produced raw materials, and so it means that the people who produce are at the bottom of the economic chain. And because we were in the West and because the law was a little hazier here, it was easy for capitalists to come in very quickly and create their own private empires in many ways, economic empires, that this displaced American Indians, that you know, maximized profit. It's our foundation. It's who we are at the beginning, and I think it explains a lot of the conservatism that you see in a lot of Colorado today, outside of places like Denver or Vail or Aspen. Colorado is a pretty conservative state, and it goes back to this idea of, you know, these myths of individualism and free enterprise and everybody's going to do well together. It didn't always work out that way here, and it's important to remember that as we go forward. It's that we have to remember who built this place.
Is it that, you know, we all do well together, or is it, you know, the hooray for me and the heck with everyone else? Because that seems to be the message that this hyper-individualism that sends to me. I'll get mine and, well...
Yeah, well, I guess that's one message that you can have when you're in your boardroom, but when you're trying to explain to coal miners why they have to go in and risk their lives for you, I think you have to have a slightly different selling point.
Yeah, so let me ask you a last line of questioning mm-hmm. I've got for you, because, you know, what we're talking about is 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this stuff happened 100, 120 years ago, and mm-hmm. and you know what's coming, because mm-hmm. I get it all the time. Well, yeah. We needed that 100 years ago, 120. Why do we need it today?
What do we need?
Organized labor. Why do we? Why is this stuff important? We aren't doing that anymore. We're not killing people in the streets. The National Guard's not shooting people in the back.
Think of what was at stake for coal miners 100 years ago. They were risking their lives to develop a source of energy. Right? That's what coal is.
Right.
It's powering everything in Colorado and in the United States 150 years ago. This is an issue that, you know, that gets us back to BP and the oil derrick. And
or West, yeah, with the explosion.
As energy becomes more and more of a precious resource, we have to work harder to make sure that there's equitable access to it. That if we don't do that, then we risk falling right back into where we were 100 years ago, when there were a few people on the top setting all the rules and a lot of people underneath who are scrambling hard just to survive. And, you know, energy is the future, and we are going to be having these conversations not only about coal but about oil and gas, about alternative sources, and who controls that energy, because who gets to have a say in that is going to have a say in our future.
And who doesn't get a say in it. And that's, to me, that's the important part. Because where we're at in Pennsylvania, though, the fracking is huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, the environmental impacts, which evidently they're not really paying attention to, and we don't get to know about, at some point we're going to end up coming to pay that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think history doesn't repeat itself, it sometimes rhymes, right?
And that's a perfect place to end this. William, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us and bringing us in here to the History Colorado Center. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It was great talking with you. William Convery, state historian and director of exhibits and interpretation here at the History Colorado Center. Quick break from the road. The People's Tour for America. Right back.
Why sing about the unions again? They have all died away. We are now in the midst of a brand new world economy. I don't believe them, I won't despair. They are a group and they're coming back to stay. 2% can't climb back up to 50% once again, my friend.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together, we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Are you ready for the Summer of Solidarity Tour? Starting August 17th, a dozen union activists and our friends from across North America will be traveling coast to coast on a 17-day, 14-city road trip, starting in Philadelphia and ending in Los Angeles on Labor Day. Each stop along the way, you're going to be organizing educational events, direct actions, as well as concerts featuring the Oldie All-Stars, legendary singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, and raptivist Michael Fraser O'Brien from Kill the Autocrat. Check out summerofsolidarity.org to find out how you can help connect the grassroots.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We're on the road. The whole crew, my wife, the kids, Pat LaMarche, our producer, Brett Banditelli, on the road. It has been an interesting couple of weeks.
Absolutely. And more work than I've ever done in my life, and I can't wait to take a nap.
Because I'm a slave driver.
He is. He's, you know, you work and work and work like a crazy amount and do all these interviews, and then we have to go 500 miles. Holy Moses. But if you're listening to this and you're thinking, wow, this sounds different from most of the shows I've been hearing lately, that's because when you come back to Rick and I, we're usually driving. We usually have a 500-mile trip that we have to stay on, so we've got to tape the pieces while the vehicle moves. But because we're on the East, well, not on the East Coast yet.
We're in Central Time.
Yeah, we're in Central Time, and the distances aren't so far. We actually get to sit still. I mean, on the folded-down table, even.
Literally in your bed.
Yeah, thanks. But, you know, this
the whole crew.
Yeah, me, Brett, and Rick. Yeah, that we could have a whole different kind of show, actually, if we just... had different kinds of sponsors. This bed is just about 2 inches shorter than me. And I'm short.
Yeah.
How do they expect normal-sized people
they
to
don't.
Sleep on these beds?
They don't.
No?
That's not what this is for.
Even on the diagonal. I mean, I'm the right length on the diagonal, but it's diagonal. But it's actually very comfy.
Good. I'm glad, because we tried to have deluxe accommodations for you because we wanted to have you along on the trip, because it's important that the person who write it be comfortable.
Yeah. Well, it certainly has to know what you guys are doing.
Aside from my two youngest kids jumping all over you.
Oh, I love that, though. They get up in that, especially Alex, who's 7. He gets up and I get a kiss and a hug every morning, and life should start that way. Everybody's day should start that way. That's pretty wonderful. You know, hard as I try to give a kiss and a hug to Brett every morning, though, I totally get the hand. No! Back off, broad. I put on my Facebook yesterday that he's my new BFF, but he doesn't know it. You know, which is the only way I actually keep friends.
There you go.
Not telling
them. They don't know them?
Yeah. They don't know the pressure I've put on them.
But, you know, this tour, this has been, you know, when we sat down and when I conceived this, when I thought, you know, this is how I want to see things work and this is how I'm going to plan it, none of that has happened.
Well, this is the only thing that I will say I actually brought to the table was I told you it was going to be completely unpredictable and that nobody would get back to you until the absolute last minute, that, you know, everything was going to be, but really, even though people have said, oh my God, Rick Smith's coming in like 20 minutes, I forgot to make 15 phone calls. They make the 15 phone calls. We have great interviews. We've had incredible people to talk to.
Yep.
I mean, the panic is like, well, it's like the ski jump thing I did at the Colorado Museum.
Then you got the gold medal on. Congratulations.
Yeah, while I was taking pictures.
While taking pictures.
Which I'm thinking it wasn't like really skiing. Because I don't think I could do a ski jump. You know, it's those really cool ski jumps where the guy goes down the big thing that looks like a Nike swoosh and then flies through the air and then lands.
See, I would be the agony of defeat guy.
Yeah.
And you're old enough to know what that means.
Right, right, right. From the beginning of the
Wide
sports
World
cast.
Of Sports thing on Saturdays that they don't do anymore.
So Sam did it with me. And Sam tried three times, and every time she wiped out when she landed. And I've skied. I didn't ski once I had kids because I couldn't afford it. But when I was a younger person, I skied all the time because I grew up in Maine. So I think that was part of it. But the other part of it is it's just a video game, right? So it's like Wii, although I've never played Wii. But it really is. But it was really fun. And it was part of that interactive part of Colorado's alpine history. All the people who go there. Why was I mentioning this?
The Olympic trial. The Olympic facilities are there.
Yeah. Pretty nice. I would go back to Colorado for vacation. That's the other thing that's crazy about this trip.
I would like, these are places I'd like to vacation.
Yeah, but we only spent 14 hours in them.
Yeah, well, you got work to do.
I know, and like, yeah. How do we get the whip away from him? But it literally would be somewhere 14 hours, and six of them would be asleep. Six or seven of them. And then, obviously, there's an eating component of this tour.
That'll be in the book. You'll want to get the eating combined.
There's a chapter on eating. I've already decided. But I'm going to see if some of these places. Kurt Vonnegut wrote a book once where all through the book he stops to put in a recipe. Like just randomly there's a recipe in the book.
Nice.
And I think I might steal the Kurt Vonnegut style thing. I'm also trying to find out if Fear and Loathing is it copyrighted. You know, like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail. Because I'd like to do Fear and Loathing of the Union House. Or something like that, Fear and Loathing of the Union Shop. You know, because if you can use Fear and Loathing without it being copyright. So if anyone knows, get a hold of Rick or me or somebody and let us know if you know if that part of the title of the books is copyrighted.
The other part, and the last part before we go to break, of going to the big museum,
mm-hmm.
I got to wear the barrel.
You did wear the barrel, and I'd never seen the barrel guy.
Barrel Man is actually in the NFL Hall of Fame.
He is. Well, he's also in the Colorado State Museum.
He is. Barrel Man is famous.
So he's a Bronco fan.
Longtime Bronco fan. Shows up. Used to show. He passed away in 2009, but showed up to every game for you know, 40 years. No, I don't think
he didn't die of frostbite.
No,
yeah.
I think he died of something in the summer. But
no menace. Yeah.
Probably had to put clothes on. I don't know, but he would go just the barrel.
So he wore the barrel. He had no shirt.
No shirt.
No
barrel with straps.
And he had cowboy boots.
And had cowboy boots.
And I tried to talk you into taking your shirt off for the Barrel Man
picture.
No one
wants to see that.
Yeah. The Barrel Man picture, though, is, and your daughter was in a barrel also. I didn't post the picture of you trying to put the barrel on, which was a funnier picture. It's like Rick with the two little hands sticking out the top of the barrel.
It's a small barrel.
It is a small barrel, but you fit.
Or I'm just a big guy. To fit in the small barrel.
Well, let's see, 55 gallons would be.
That was a 40-gallon barrel, I'll have you know. 55-gallon barrels are the big steel ones.
Oh.
Those little cardboard ones are 40 gallons.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
8 pounds in a gallon, 40 times 8, what is that, 320? No.
Well, I'm a little less than that, but thanks for that.
Well, and that's just water. I'm sure there's plenty of muscle. I'm sure you're not all water.
Anyway, going to take a quick break. On the road, the People's Tour for America. Stick around. I'm right back.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers in China held a U.S. businessman in captivity until he reached a compensation agreement for employees concerned that they may be displaced when some jobs are moved to India. Specialty Medical Supplies co-owner Chip Starnes was blocked from leaving when workers became concerned that they may not be fairly compensated if they're laid off. Starnes was allowed to leave after he reached an agreement with a union negotiator. Starnes has said the company wasn't planning to lay off many of the workers who fall under the agreed-to package and told the Associated Press that he'd be rehiring some workers who had been previously let go. A new website is seeking to provide workers with the tools they need to create changes in their workplace. Coworker.org is a petition site that allows workers to build support as they endeavor to create a positive environment on the job. Jess Kutch is one of the co-founders of Coworker.org and provided an example of one way the site is being used successfully.
We have about 12 campaigns running on the site. We're really excited about a campaign that's running right now by Capital Bike Share employees. Capital Bike Share is DC's bike share program, and the employees there believe that they're owed more than $100,000 in back pay, as well as health and welfare benefits from the company. So they launched a petition. They've gotten a ton of local support, and they also got media coverage from outlets all over the country. And this week the company responded and said they're working to rectify the problem very quickly.
The site was inspired by the success Kutch saw with consumer petitions putting pressure on companies.
Workers need more support than a 17-year-old who's trying to ban plastic bags in her town. When you're going up against your boss, you're taking on a lot of risk, and there's a lot at stake. So Coworker.org is really committed to figuring out what kinds of support workers need to win these campaigns.
While the site is still in beta, the team behind Coworker.org are putting together resources that will help inform workers about their rights in the workplace and how to appropriately cope with an employer who may push back against the petition campaign. Macy's has agreed to pay $175,000 after a federal investigation determined the retail chain had discriminated against immigrant employees. The fine includes a $100,000 fund that will compensate the workers who had been unfairly terminated, suspended, or punished. Under the settlement, Macy's denied its practices were discriminatory or unfair. While details of the investigation weren't made available to the public, the Department of Justice said the company used unfair documentary practices.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, Pat, I listened to Al's, listened to the interview we did with Alan. You know, this is a guy who, you know, when I'm 80 years old, I'm thinking I want to be on a beach somewhere. I'm thinking I want to be doing, well, something. But he's out there fighting.
You know, Al, you're going to be just like him.
You think?
You're even going to look like him. He was big and strong still. I never would have guessed he was
over
60. Yeah. He was rugged. I thought it was kind of cute that all the memorabilia and little tchotchkes in his house were like Santa looking, because he kind of looked like Santa Claus. But
I would have to think that that's his wife's doing.
Yeah, I think so too.
I doubt that anything on display in his home had anything to do with him.
Yeah, the father, big Father Christmas and stuff. There also was quite a display of Native American art, which was pretty nice. You know, I think He was really neat, and that's the other thing I'm really liking about this tour. Not that, I mean, I completely expected it because my mother was such an advocate for fairness, and my mom, of course, a labor union member, and then all of her family. Also, my uncle, who died of asbestosis, would have died without health care if it hadn't been for his union. But this respect for what racism did to the country. You know, these labor union guys we're talking to in the 21st century are like, yeah, that really wasn't our land. It really wasn't our land to give to the railroads. It really wasn't our land to give to the coal companies. And it really wasn't their land to screw the worker with. You know, and they are very aware of that. You know, and when they talk about things like slavery and the slaughter of the Indians, they are acutely aware that that was wrong. And I'll tell you what, you talk to them, an awful lot of people who aren't this crowd, and they're like, well, yeah, but it happened, and now we've got this.
No, yeah, move on.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, one of the things that Al had said to me off air when we were talking, you know, as we were wrapping up and heading out, you know, he had talked about building his home, and he said he built it like 20 years ago. And he said never could have done that, you know, had he not been a union member.
had he not had the jobs that paid a decent wage and gave him the ability in retirement. I mean, because think about it. 20 years ago, he said he was in his 80s. That would have been in the 60s.
He's still not retired, though. He's still working.
Yeah, well.
He's still working, and he can, because he just doesn't have to work that hard. He's got a pension.
Yeah.
But he's still working, and I thought that was great. And he's very politically involved. Another message he wants to send out there. You get the politics you deserve because you sleep on the couch instead of being involved. Or you work your third job. That is also part of keeping people poor. They just don't
keep
have
them on the treadmill.
Yeah, they don't have the political voice they'd have if they had a little bit of downtime.
Head down on the treadmill, just hoping never to fall off.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty awful. It's George Jetson without the humor.
Yeah, but by the time we finished up with Al, we couldn't make it down to Ludlow because the site had closed. And the sad reality of that, and I had forgotten that a year or two ago that there had been some vandalism at the site where they had literally cut the heads off of the statues.
What?
Yeah, and they've been repaired, and I had forgotten that they, because I guess you used to be able to go.
Cutting the heads off the original people wasn't good enough?
No, burning them. Burning them wasn't good enough.
And asphyxiating them and shooting them in the back of the head?
But, you know, we found out from Al that they closed off the area, and you can't get into it now. So that's why we chose to move on down the road, away from Ludlow, because, you know, why go if you're fenced out? But I do want to go back at some point around the 100th anniversary. I think that would be something special as well if we could figure out a way of getting that done.
That would be the strike started in September of 12 and ended with the massacre, or at least the massacre happened. I don't know if it ended in April of 13. So did the strike end when the massacre happened, or did it keep going?
It kept going, but I think, you know, that's what... It was the massacre that drew public ire.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to be honest with you, burning women and children. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. When you go in and you burn 11 women and children, people tend to go, that's probably, or most sane, rational people go, that's probably not in the best interest of anyone. At least I think.
Yeah, I, you know what? God love you. I think we burn women and children all the time. I mean, I don't think the Iraq War could have been executed if we couldn't stomach that idea. I think we do it all the time, and we as a nation have to start owning that. And, you know, if you think we burned women and children in Ludlow for natural resources, what the hell do you think happened in Iraq? You know, and that's why we have to empower people. It's funny, when World War II ended, before the Marshall Plan went into effect, we went door to door and did this thing called denazifying the Germans. Showed them pictures from the concentration camps and said, this is what your country did. This is what your country did. This is what your country did. And we went literally door to door, confiscated their weapons, how Second Amendment of us, and then showed them what they did in the war. And we've never done that in the United States. We've never said, own it now. Suck it up and own it. This is, you know, you tolerated us killing Indians, but then all of a sudden you were surprised when they killed women and children at Ludlow? That same ruthless nature of the corporate leaders, it doesn't change a bit.
Yeah, but we don't learn about Ludlow, and we don't learn about the other massacres. I mean, where we live in Pennsylvania, you know, the Latimer Massacre happened just, you know, a couple miles up the road in Hazleton. And how many people who lived, when we went and we talked about that on the 115th anniversary not too long ago. I actually had listeners who say, I lived in that area my whole life, never knew about it.
Well, you have new listeners now, so tell us what happened in Latimer.
It was the same basic thing. You had these workers who were marching from Allentown up to Scranton.
And were they coal miners?
They were coal miners who, you know, they're doing the same thing. They want to organize for better wages, hours, conditions. They want to get off company script. They want to be able to go to their own doctor. They want to be able to go to their own store. They want to be able to start their own stores.
Mm-hmm.
But, the company towns and these coal barons, they had, they had you by the short hairs.
Right.
This band of workers, union members, were marching from Allentown to Scranton. And while going through that area, the sheriff deputized 100 locals and said, you're now deputies. Here's a brand new Winchester rifle.
Do they get to keep the rifle? I mean, why would they do this?
Because we got to protect ourselves from those people. So you have this group of people who are walking totally unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
And The massacre ensued. A shot fired, bang, bunch, 19 workers dead, 50 more injured, wounded. You know, the one guy who was quoted, you know, from his children said, you know, he feared nothing because he had the American, he was carrying the American flag. So he thought that that would protect him.
Yeah, like, good luck with that.
And, you know, the article that I read on it, you know, said, you know, they found him draped in a blood-soaked flag, shot in the back.
Huh.
And you go up to the site, and they have a little marker and a nice little display, but it's, you know, it's really hard to get to. It's difficult. It's at the point of a triangle there as it forks off. But there's something there.
Yeah.
What's amazing to me is we go to a lot of these places and it's, there's nothing. Yeah. It's not that it just didn't happen. It was deliberately undone. I mean, we went to Blair.
Yeah, and Blair.
What did you find in Blair? Nothing.
They took the roads away.
I mean, when I stood there.
They took the roads away.
When I stood in that one spot and you looked out and you said, you know, there were 10,000 workers here who were fighting for. I'm going, I can't imagine there being 10,000 crickets here.
You sat at the railroad crossing. The railroad crossing was taken away.
Gone. Everything.
It's the sanitizing of our history so we don't know about it. It is amazing. And my God, that seems like 30 years ago when we were in Blair.
Yeah, oh boy, does it.
Oh, by the way, people showing up with guns again. 2013, just coming to ask a few questions. Just journalists, hello, just coming to ask a few questions. And the next thing you know, what's the sidearm for?
Well,
okay, I know what it's for. It's because you're compensating. Sorry there, sir, but I know that that's not a good sign. I'm telling you right now, I don't even have to look. If you've got a sidearm, we know.
Well, then.
Feeling bad for you. See if we can't get you a prescription. You know what? Let's make fun of them. Let's make fun. That's what they deserve. Yeah. They deserve to be made fun of. Come on over to the good side, people. Your life will improve.
But here's the thing, you know.
Your life will get better.
I think what's happened in those areas is that's all they've heard. That's all they've been told. And all they think of is, well, you're trying to steal their jobs.
Would you take up a gun against another person in this country?
That depends.
What would the message be? There's a bunch of people. They come from Saudi Arabia or some other Arab town, and if you don't shoot them, they're going to march through your town. What would it take to make you kill another human being just on the rumor that they were bad?
No, not that. I'm thinking my kids, you know.
Well, what if this is 100 people? They deputized 100 people, and these people shot these people. What would it take? What is wrong with America? We're surprised that Aurora, Colorado happened when 100 Americans will just take up a gun on the rumor that somebody might be bad and shoot them? Really? It's like massive mental illness.
Yeah. But part of the reason why we're doing this tour, and if you've missed any portion of our tour, therickssmithshow.com or People's Tour for America, going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show. Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So the People's Tour for America on the road. Left out of Denver about 2 hours ago, 116 miles south on 25 southbound. We found our way here to Pueblo, Colorado. They used to have a federal, every time we turn on TV, you could get a pamphlet. And it was somewhere in Pueblo, Colorado.
Yeah, why was that?
The federal bookstore.
Yeah, that must have been what it was.
That was the federal bookstore here in and it's still operating.
Oh,
it's
is it?
Still operating. You still can get government-printed material from Pueblo, Colorado.
There you go. Now my question is answered. The tour now completely worth it. We're in the home of Al Becco. He is a staffer with the Alliance for American Manufacturing and a retired steel worker, 80 years old. Al, thanks for inviting us into your home and your willingness to talk to us about the history of the area.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So the Pueblo, the federal book thing, still here?
Yes.
Because I was wondering, because I haven't seen those commercials in ages. Since everything ended up on the Internet.
Well, since the cutbacks, they don't advertise. But they used to be real big before. They had a big office and everything. But they still got a little small office. And they still, you can still get printed material, government printed material from Pueblo, Colorado.
So let's talk about why we're here. You know, we're in Denver. We looked at some of the things that went on in Denver. I spoke with a really great guy at the Colorado History Center. You know, Ludlow, as we're making our way south, we're going to go down to Trinidad and look at the Ludlow site. We wanted to go and you know, talk to someone who was in the area who was affected by the history of what went on.
Well, I think everybody was affected, but a lot of people didn't know how they was affected. But I had an uncle that worked as a coal miner in them days of the Ludlow. When the strikes began, they wanted to an 8-hour day instead of a 10-hour day, and they wanted a 40-hour week. That started the Ludlow strike. And these miners all stayed home from work. And so when they stayed home, and the corporation hired, I don't know what you'd call them.
Thugs.
Thugs or
goons.
And they would beat up on people to get them to go back to work. If they got a few back, then they could get the rest back. But they stuck together, and that's what really formed the unions that we have today. If it wasn't for their strong commitments for this, we wouldn't have some of our unions today.
So they didn't hire people to just take the jobs? They didn't hire scabs? They hired people to beat them up?
That's right.
And beat them back to work. Because, you know, coal mining is a dangerous job, and you need a skill.
Jobs. And most people wouldn't take the coal mining jobs. So they couldn't go out and just hire a bunch of coal miners and put them in on the jobs. They just, and at that time, coal was a valuable commodity. They wanted to produce it in high quantities, in which they did. And this is another thing with when they went on strike. They wanted to produce more for less pay on the amount of cars they produced. They used to have like an incentive plan that you load so many cars of coal. And they wanted to double their load of cars and for the same pay.
Now, your uncle was one of these strikers. How did your uncle die?
Oh, he's been dead quite a few years ago. He came out of World War II. He was in the 1st Division in World War II. But he was a coal miner.
So he didn't die of a coal mining related?
No, he did not die of a black lung or anything like that. But they all, most miners, like my dad and them that was coal miners, they all got black lung. My dad had black lung when he died, but it wasn't the reason why he died. He was 90 years old in this old age.
And what happened?
This is a tough bunch, this Becco bunch.
You know, and what happened to the guys who got black lung back then?
Well, they didn't even know they had it until the last few years when the unions was telling people to check and see if they had black lung, and then they start checking, and a lot of them start getting. And then all the miners applied for black lung benefits. But that would have never come about if it wasn't for the unions.
So when these guys got sick, and you call it whatever you wanted, they didn't know what it was before.
No.
They didn't know what it was. They just knew they were sick. They knew they couldn't breathe. They knew their lungs were filling up with fluid. They knew this. What happened to those guys before the unions said, hey, you know, We need to take care of these people.
They just went by the wayside, like ever. Nobody, you know, they didn't know. Nobody knew. Just like some of the deals in the, we worked in the mills for years on some of the hazardous conditions that we didn't know at that time. You take in the early 40s and 50s, that some things were not known.
Or some didn't care.
Or some didn't care.
I mean, you look at these big companies, and we've talked in the past over this tour, how many of these companies were cutting corners so that they can make more profit.
That's right. That's what the main strike of Ludlow was about. Because they was working 10-hour days, and they wanted to work to 8 hours, and they worked 7 days a week. No days off. And it's kind of tiresome, 10 hours a day.
Yeah, especially doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
You know, having known a relative who was there, who was actually a part of this, what was passed down through the generations? What stories were told? What was the thought that was passed down?
Well, what was passed down is guys like me from my generation. I was a strong union guy and still am to this day. And and a lot of people didn't know what the union really does for them. A lot of people don't know today what the union had done for them. They figured the unions ruined our country. I've heard a lot of people tell me, damn unions caused all the prices to go up and everything like that.
Well, they would say they caused those guys to realize they had black lung.
Yeah.
See, before they didn't know.
Yeah.
Now they know, and now it's the union's fault.
You know, now that you mention it, it was a union that told my uncle that he had asbestosis after putting in asbestos roofs for, 50 years or whatever.
Blame it on the union. It's their fault. He would have never known what he had.
Well, that's the same way with me as a steel worker, that I had asbestos. I worked with asbestos. They never did tell me. We wore asbestos aprons in the open hearts. Just put them on.
Wow. An asbestos apron. Here, have this poison. Drink it. It'll take good care of you.
Yeah. And just like I said, it was a union. You know, this is something with manufacturing. Because when I first started in the steel mills, it took anywhere from 6 to 8.5 hours to make 100 ton of steel. We can make it in 20 minutes now. So just imagine how many 100-ton of steel we can put out now.
Yeah.
In comparison with what they did a long time ago.
You know, that's the investment in technology. And, since you brought up steel, and this is away from the Ludlow, the Ludlow
coal mine
that we were talking about, the right loves to say it was the unions who put the steel mills in the U.S. out of business. Yeah. It was the workers who did that. And I've always said it's not the workers, it was the investment. It was the technology, because if you looked around Japan and Germany, they were investing in better technology, while the big steel companies in this country were buying hotels and golf courses.
Right.
In other countries, they're investing in technology.
This is true.
Now, why didn't you become a coal miner?
When I was my age, I just went to the steel mills, and studied the coal mines. The coal mines were dropping back and cutting back, and so the jobs, the future in the coal mining industry wasn't that great. So that's one reason why I didn't become a coal miner.
You know, before we started this segment, you had said that what happened in Ludlow made your life better, and pretty much everyone in this region's lives better.
Yeah, well, what happened is, they were striking for an 8-hour day and a 40-hour week.
And minimum wage.
Minimum wage.
And health and safety on the job. Yeah. All the things that we take for granted today.
And if they were, and if they didn't get it, because the militia come down there, and they not only killed union personnel, they killed women and children. And this is how they got it back, because it was a regular riot. And the corporation that owned the coal mines then was John D. Rockefeller, that owned all the steel mills, too.
Yeah. So did your uncle talk to you about what the town, here a town hears that they're killing women and children. What happened in the town?
Well, in the town, when they was killing, I guess it was turmoil during that strike. And there's some real historians, books written about that.
You know, when the governor sends in the militia. With guns ablazing.
Yeah, it was bad. Especially, it not only hit the strikers, it hit the women and children.
Who they burned, they basically killed.
And the only reason the Union held so long together, when you go down there to see, they had tunnels from place to place. Since they were miners, they tunneled the whole area. They could walk from house to house. And all through tunnels. And so the people never come up, but they could never figure out how they could stop people from going to work as scabs and stuff. But they used to travel underground through tunnels.
Can we go in those tunnels when we get down there?
They'll show them to you, but you can't go in them. No.
Now, when we go down there, we're heading down that way once we leave your home, and we appreciate you inviting us into your home to talk about this. What should we see, and what will we see?
You will see a statue of a woman and a child. And these were some of the people that were, and the list of names of all the people that died there at that particular time. And then they're going to show you the tunnels that these miners had to go from place to place.
Now, if we get there after business hours, are we going to be able to poke around anyway?
Well, I don't know, since they got it fenced off. If they shut it down on business hours, you won't be able to get to it. Because they had a lot of destruction.
Yeah.
Here a few years ago, they broke the statues. Sad. And it's all been repaired now. And it's the United Mine Workers Union Hall down there.
Let me ask you this, Al. You know, in looking at this horrible tragedy and this, well, the power of the gun the government has over people, you know, I have people who say, you know, that was 100 years ago. In fact, it's going to literally be 100 years in a couple of months.
Well, that's right. This year is the 100-year anniversary.
They say, you know, that was 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. We're so much better than that now. That's our past. What do you say to them as someone who's seen all that you've seen over the years?
It was our past, but I see our future, they're trying to do the same thing. Anytime, in my opinion, that some of the rich don't share their wealth with some of the poor, you can cause these strikes and riots. That's all it was. They just wanted a fair wage for a day's work.
And nowadays, support their families.
Yeah, support their family. Nowadays, some of these people are working two or three jobs just to support, just to pay, get a house payment, and they can't. Some of them can't buy gas to go anywhere, and some just lucky to put food on the table. With especially the jobs, our jobs now, most are minimum wage jobs. And it isn't enough to where our commodities are higher than it was. Yes, so we're going backwards in time and study forwards in time.
Which is the reason we decided to do this history tour, to learn what the past, what happened in the past, so we don't repeat it in the future. Because I see a lot of the same themes popping up again, using different divisions, ethnicities, men, women, Mexicans, whatever. Yeah. To divide us and keep us separated and pitted against one another, which was one of the key themes of Ludlow as well.
That's true. And they're doing a lot of things like, we got study getting the stimulus money, to do jobs and build up our cities and schools. And we haven't got any. They said they didn't work, but it does work.
It did work. Absolutely. Yeah. It did. It just wasn't big enough.
And there's no way to tell what it would have been without it. But I think we would have seen a 20% unemployment rate if it hadn't been for the stimulus package.
That's true.
We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're in the home of Al Becco here in Pueblo, Colorado, on the People's Tour for America. When we come back, Al, I'd like to talk about where you think the future is, where we're going to go, what we need to be doing. Have you heard what happened in the past? I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on in the future. We're going to take a quick break here from Pueblo, Colorado, the People's Tour for America, right back after this. You're
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at TheRickSmithShow.com or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. And, of course, if you've missed any of the People's Tour for America, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, find out where we've been, where we're going, and who we've spoken with. We're in the home of Al Becco here in Pueblo, Colorado. And, again, Al, thank you so much for inviting us into your beautiful home.
You're welcome.
You know, before we talk about the future, I wanted to go and talk a little bit. We've talked about what happened in Ludlow and back 100 years ago. But, you know, back in the 90s, there was a huge strike here. One of the longest in the history of steel.
Right. It was.
Tell me, you know, what were the themes surrounding around that? And how much different was it then in the 90s than it was 100 years ago?
Well, a lot different. For the first reason, this is the first time in this long strike that they took and hired scab workers to go in and work. And
President Clinton, then? Was it the 90s after 92?
It was Bush.
H.W. Bush.
The other Bush.
Yeah.
But Bush the elder.
The spawn.
Yeah. The older Bush. And then it lasted through all the
Clinton
Bush years. And, Clinton kind of stopped it. Clinton actually was the best because manufacturing, we still was running at full pace. But when the Junior Bush took over in the United States, we lost manufacturing jobs by millions every month. 2 to 3 million manufacturing jobs every month was going out of the United States.
They were shipping the factories out. They were dismantling the factories and moving the factories.
Yeah, they were dismantling everything and moving out. So now for the unions to go on strike and they'd hire scab workers to come in, they couldn't fight the issue.
which is why I voted for Bill Clinton when I did.
Yeah.
Because he had said that he was going to pursue a strike replacement bill, which, to his credit, he did pursue, and Bob Dole filibustered, and the two Democrats from Arkansas voted against.
And they never got it.
And we never got it. To me, it's another one of those moments in labor history where the Democrats, again, that good shot in the back, much like the Employee Free Choice Act of the Obama years.
Right. Right.
Now, you've taken on a political. You've been president of your union for 20 years, and you got political when you needed to. So tell us a little bit about that, and then what do you do about these people who let you down?
Well, you know, if all these people let me down, it really disappoints me, you know, because if I let it bother me, I'd probably go crazy. But you have to say, well, we'll try again and keep on trying. We'll keep fighting. We never accomplished anything. But one thing, you know, just like when we started AAM, most everybody didn't even know what AAM meant for American manufacturing, and wanted to bring jobs, manufacturing jobs, back in the United States. This is where you got good-paying jobs. People can afford to make a good, decent living. Right now, if you get all our jobs as people working in fast food organizations, they cannot live on the minimum wage.
Which is why we need to raise the minimum wage and give those workers the right to organizing. Because one of the things that I'd like to, just for a second, because you go back, one of my frames, and you can help me if, whether you think I'm right or wrong, one of my frames is that the coal mining jobs of 100 years ago, the steel worker jobs and the smelting plants and the coke plants of 100 years ago, truck drivers, all of those jobs, those weren't livable wage jobs. Those weren't middle class jobs. They became middle class living wage jobs because they organized and they fought for a decent living.
That's right. That's how they got to be. And if you go to comparison now, where a lot of the unions, they got less membership, less money. So they didn't have the money to fight like they should be fighting right now. But then we also got to build up our character, because some people think the union's the one that destroyed it, because all the news media and everything's against the unions. You never read anything good about the unions.
And what the unions are the workers. And that's the thing that gets me. Yeah. You got the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media and all of these wealthy people saying, it's those workers. It's you, Al. Yeah. It's me. It's our fault.
That's true. That's true.
Because they've done a great job of divorcing us from our union.
This is it. And they've done a great job at convincing some people that the unions didn't help any. But they're wrong. Because every salary and wages was based off of union scale wages for somebody else.
They've attacked the teachers. I can't think, teachers' unions. I can't think of a group of people I'd rather not have attacked than teachers.
Yeah, that's true.
Nurses are next.
Yeah. And if you notice, right now, they don't believe in getting people educated, like they're going to college. Take the college, for instance. That's a sorry thing that they put in, that these students have to pay such a high rate of interest when we let the stock market get borrow money from the bank for real hardly no interest at all. Now, there's something wrong with our country when we start doing that. And then another thing's wrong with our country. A lot of our people that's making big money don't believe in making America great. They want to go live overseas and have two or three slave or labor guys doing the work for them. And this is what happened.
How do you tell somebody that you can say there's something wrong with our country and still love your country? I mean, anyone who criticizes the country they want to throw us out. You don't like it?
Yeah, they'll say, you don't like it, leave. Or get another job. I heard that too. But when there ain't no job to get, you can't get another job.
And even if there is, why not make this one better?
Better, yeah, right. And so it makes my blood boil every time I hear somebody say this. It was the unions that caused this. The unions are the ones that raised and priced us out of the market. That's not necessarily true. But when they kill a bunch of people like that making clothes over there in Bangladesh. It wasn't the unions. The unions would be fighting to keep jobs like in this country, and we would make it safe jobs.
You know what gets me is those stuff's made over there. I used to shop at Macy's before the Bangladesh thing, and they wouldn't sign the agreement to save the workers, to protect the workers. They're making stuff for Macy's, and I'm going in there buying a suit for $200. It cost them 25 cents.
Yeah. This is true. Their profit margin has tripled, quadrupled, and the labor is not.
And it's not any cheaper. They took the jobs away. I still pay $200 for a suit.
Yeah, that's the same way me. I was so mad at here a while back. I went to a football game this winter, and I was going to buy a hat. My son said, "You better buy a hat for the Broncos." I said, "Okay, I'll go look." I go in there, and it wasn't one hat made in the United States.
I was just there yesterday.
And I said, you know, that's a crying shame. They want $30 for that baseball hat, and I got union hats made in the United States for less than $30.
$32 for a hat, $34 for a shirt,
yeah,
made, could be child labor for all I know.
Yeah.
I know they weren't union workers, and I know it wasn't here.
I know it. That's what happens to our country. We've got to get back to making things fair and honest.
And the other part of it, you know, and I've talked about this earlier, the other part of it is, you know, not only can I wear the Broncos hat that I paid $32 for, I didn't, but I would, I've got to wear the corporate logo with it, which
right.
drove me, which is the final straw. Yeah. I am not wearing the Nike check mark on my hat.
Yeah, right. And that's the same way I felt. In fact, I jumped the manager. I said, I'll buy one of them hats if you got one made in America. We looked through the host. He didn't have one made in America. Same way with the shirt. Now, when you're paying $35, $40 for a shirt, I know we got American companies can make them shirts for $30 and $40. So we got to train some of our people in this country, study buying foreign goods, to buy American-made goods.
And to look and to be informed consumers. And to have the options. Because, you know, I have people say, well, you can choose to buy that. No, I can't. When you go to the big box retailers, there isn't a screwdriver made in the U.S. and one made in China. I don't get to make that choice. They're both made in China.
I don't understand why people don't understand that if you buy a hat made in the United States for $30, say, it's going to be $6 profit per hat. But if you buy one that's made in Bangladesh for $30, it's $24 profit, including the shipping.
This is true.
Yeah.
And everybody's greedy, and that's what's the biggest part of our country right now. And greed can tear down a country. You know, after they get so high and they put people down so low, then you're going to have riots and revolution.
That's unfortunate part of this.
And you can see some of that working.
Well, that's why Junior expanded, George Bush Jr. expanded food stamps. Because he's the one who expanded food stamps. It's just under Obama, that President Obama, that they used him. But he expanded food stamps because he knew he was making people starve.
This is true.
You know, it's a good thing both of you are sitting down, because while I was in the Broncos store, because I'm a huge Broncos fan, I was looking at one of the game jerseys they had on sale. $300.
Oh, gee.
$300 for me to wear a shirt with somebody else's name on it.
Name on it, right.
Couldn't even get
my
own name
on it. I got to say something. Thank you for this shirt I've been wearing for 3 straight weeks with your name on it. I at least got it for free.
And by the way, they look like pretty good shirts.
They're union made.
That's exactly
it. And I bet you they're union made.
Absolutely. So let me ask you, let's move this to the future now. You know, you're 80 years old. You know, your work life is, you know, coming to a close. You've tried to do better for your kids, your grandkids. What are you seeing in the future for my 11-year-old? What are you seeing in the future for the next generation?
Well, this is why we're still fighting for them. You know, right now, they're after us seniors to pay the load. They want us to cut Social Security. And these are not given benefits. We paid for that.
Absolutely.
We paid so much Social Security tax.
But Al, don't you feel good knowing that your little bit of sacrifice is going to help keep the billionaire class well healed? Aren't you happy to know that we've got 1,300 billionaires in the country? You could go without, couldn't you?
Let me tell you,
1,300 billionaires.
I wouldn't know how billionaire lives, you know, because I think I'm doing pretty good just right now. I don't need all that money. What is he going to do with it?
You know, this was a statistic we've been throwing around since the trip. It came out about 10 days into the trip, and that's that the top 10, the Forbes top 10 income people in the country make as much as every fast food worker combined. All three, or more than 3 million fast food workers make the same as 10 people.
Well, yeah, this is what needs to be changed. This is why you got active people like me. I'm still going to be arguing and fighting. I can't see some fast food workers, like they're saying, Obamacare is killing us. We can't afford to pay a health insurance for them. Well, I remember the billionaire, the guy who runs Papa John Pizzas, said he couldn't afford health insurance for his employees.
11 cents a pizza, and they found out that number was higher than inflated.
Yeah, highly inflated.
You know what? I hope he goes out of business.
That's right. I don't want to buy Papa John Pizzas.
I won't either.
Because for that simple reason. And that's the only way we got to combat it.
He needs to go out of business, and some guy who doesn't mind an extra 11 cents a pizza and even is willing to pass it on to the consumer can sell me a pizza.
That's right. That's why, another thing, that's why I shop at Costco's if I get a chance and study Walmart. Because Walmart doesn't treat their workers fair, and they're all for profit. But I see they're finally changing some because they got so many people complaining that they ain't nothing made in the United States.
Well, they're changing because it's a good PR stunt. We're going to add $5 billion over the next decade, which is such a small amount of American-made products. But it's the PR part of this. And I don't know if you remember after Hurricane Katrina, and I'm sure you do, where Walmart had a line of trucks that they had brought in. I think it was like $8 million worth of water they brought in to New Orleans. $8 million, and they should be lauded for that. They spent $18 million promoting the fact that they sent $8 million worth of water in. That's the thing that gets me.
I used to be the director of the Children's Miracle Network. Largest owner, allegedly, Walmart, right? Like $20 million a year. Almost every penny of it is their associates and their customers. They sell those little paper balloons.
Yeah.
Walmart gets all the credit for it, but it's the associates and the customers that pay for they give them the money.
This is true. This is what some of our corporations need to be straightened out in this country.
So when are you running for president?
Yeah, when are you running for
fabulous.
President? No, I wouldn't want to run for president. I want to be on the sidelines hollering when they do something wrong.
Keep them in check.
And I believe that. We need more active people bitching and complaining like I do every day.
And I understand you had a pretty sizable victory, you know, because we've talked about the Bay Bridge in California, where they used predominantly Chinese-made steel and actually brought in Chinese welders because there's not enough people here that know how to weld here in the U.S. You had a local victory of
sorts.
That's
right, I did. When we went down there and started raising hell about using Chinese steel, automatically they got rid of this Chinese steel and brought in steel from the United States. But we still had a steel mill right here, 30 miles away. But the steel didn't come from that. But it was still within the United States. So
what sense does that make? I mean, 30 miles away, they make the steel here. Why wouldn't you use local steel? Why would you go to China first and then, well, somewhere? It doesn't make any sense.
It never makes any sense to me. How you can ship something from overseas and put it right on our shores cheaper than we can make it.
Well, easy. You use exploitable labor and horrible environmental laws and all of that. But the other part of it is why, as someone who's building that project, don't you want the reverberation effects from the building? Not only did you build the bridge, but you made the steel. You created jobs in both parts. To me, that seems like a win-win for everybody.
This is the same way I feel about it. We need to do that, especially when you're using our taxpayers' dollars. These are our taxpayers' dollars that built them bridges. You know, I don't see no big corporation putting a sign, "I built this bridge." You know,
and if they do, they're going to put up a big toll booth saying,
"Yeah,
we built this bridge, now pay us every
that's
day."
Right.
You know, Maine has the only member of the United States Congress that's a labor union member, and his name's Mike Michaud. He's a United States congressman from Maine. And he's one of the ones who proposed the bill that all the soldiers have to wear U.S.-made clothes they can't wear foreign-made clothes.
That was a good bill. I thought that was a damn good bill.
And then, after they passed it, he went and looked closer, and they were still buying foreign shoes. He's like, wait a minute.
Those aren't clothes. It's
shoes they make in Maine. You know, he's trying to help his own people, too. So he had to go back and have a whole other bill put through for the shoes.
I know it. In fact, I think there's only one shoe outfit now, and that's the ones that I wear.
The New Balance.
New Balance.
The tennis shoes that I wear, Brett's got.
Made in Skowhegan, Maine.
There you go. Yeah,
that's right.
And it's not all of them. You have to really look for them. And that's the thing that gets me. I've got to spend my day to look. And you know, when I take the kids shopping, it's like a geography lesson.
Yeah.
Where this stuff is made.
Right. It is. And so, this is what we got to change to this guy.
So the last question I've got for you, and looking at the direction of the country, for me, most of it comes back down to our insane trade policies. The NAFTAs, the GATS, the WTOs, the CORUSes, the Columbias, all of, and coming very soon, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. All of these trade agreements have been put in place not to help you and me and workers like us, but to help the multinationals and the very wealthy continue to be very wealthy.
Yeah, this is true.
What do we need to do? I mean,
we need to point it out. And, you know, a lot of people are not aware of, you know, the average lowly voters that can change this country needs to be made educated on how some of these people are running it. Mm-hmm. And we need to point this out to some of our people. Because they don't agree. We should be building up our country and study. These people just want profits.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at our military. I mean, I think the one thing across the political spectrum that I think you can get everybody to agree on is we should be making our own fighter planes and our own nuts and bolts and our own smart chips that make the smart bombs smart and all of those other things.
We just bought Russian planes for Turkey.
Yeah.
We just bought Russian planes for Turkey.
That's right. That's true.
You were stupid.
Well, that's the same. I don't like.
If you're going to give them technology, why not give them someone else's?
For God's sake. So, you know, we ought to buy one and see what the Russians are up to.
Wow.
Well, that's true. But I think we need to have our own technology, and we need to build that up. You know. If you remember, we cut down a lot of our experimentals.
All the research and development, sure.
We don't do that no more.
Remember when the Russian sub sank about 8 years ago and they let the whole crew die because they didn't want the U.S. to get the sub?
Yep.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what you do for technology. And remember when the U.S. plane went down, U.S. Navy plane went down in China? And China kept the plane, and we were like, oh, that's okay.
And the drone that went down in Iran?
Well, this one that went down in China, a friend of mine who works at Walmart said, you know, we didn't make a fuss over that plane because Walmart shelves would be empty.
That's true.
I'd be happy to see that day.
Yeah.
Al, we really appreciate you inviting us into your home. Thank you so much for sharing your history, your knowledge. We really appreciate it.
I hope I shared something, you know. Sometimes my knowledge is not great.
No, you're fantastic. We really appreciate it.
But a lot of people needs to be aware of facts.
And we need to hear people's stories, and we need to be passing these down from generation to generation. And that's why I thank you for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Al Becco. Quick break, right back on the People's Tour for America, heading down to Trinidad, Colorado, to the Ludlow Massacre site. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Are you ready for the Summer of Solidarity Tour. Starting August 17th, a dozen union activists and our friends from across North America will be traveling coast to coast on a 17-day, 14-city road trip, starting in Philadelphia and ending in Los Angeles on Labor Day. Each stop along the way, you're going to be organizing educational events, direct actions, as well as concerts featuring the Oldie All-Stars, legendary singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, and raptivist Michael Fraser O'Brien from Kill the Autocrat. Check out summerofsolidarity.org to find out how you can help connect the grassroots.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show from Denver, Colorado, as we wrap up this adventure we've had here in Denver. And this has been a really, I think, a good day. I've enjoyed our time here in Denver and in Colorado.
I just loved Al Becco. I mean, what is this, like sixth person I want to ask to marry me? I mean,
Back to Utah.
Oh, what a great idea! Does it work for women? Can women have multiple husbands? Brother husbands, like sister wives?
They should be.
That would be a little equality.
See, now, where's the movement for that?
Right here. Come on over. No, really, I mean, I don't ask these people to marry me because I realize that they were nice and they don't deserve that sort of punishment.
Yeah.
But there are just so many great people. There's just, I did want to marry a couple of inanimate objects, too, in this trip, but I can't remember what they are right now. But really, it's just been wonderful to meet these guys that are sweet and kind and
passionate,
and they care not only about their own family, but this expanded brotherhood they have. So we're going to head east now. Easter. We've been going east.
East.
And I just wanted to give you a quick little heads up. I got an email, and it said, watch out in Kansas. Supposedly there are a lot of cops.
Don't want to get pulled over.
No, wouldn't want to.
Because we've already gone like 7,000 miles.
Yeah, and this is a taped program, so we wouldn't want anyone to think that actually you already had been pulled over in Kansas and we know about it after the fact.
So, no, it's just that you're clairvoyant.
Yeah, I might just recommend that.
There you go.
Yeah.
We take
Watch
it
your
easy.
Speed. Yeah.
Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com or PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious.